This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Difference Engine by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling, performed by Simon Vance. First Iteration: The Angel of Goliad. Composite image, optically encoded by escort craft of the trans-channel airship Lord Brunel. Aerial view of suburban Cherbourg. October 14th, 1905. A villa. A garden. A balcony. Erase the balcony's wrought iron curves, exposing a bath chair and its occupant. Reflected sunset glints from the nickel plate of the chair's wheel spokes. The occupant, owner of the villa, rests her arthritic hands upon fabric woven by a Jacquard loom. These hands consist of tendons, tissue, jointed bone. Through quiet processes of time and information, threads within the human cells have woven themselves into a woman. Her name is Sybil Gerard. Below her, in a neglected formal garden, leafless vines lace wooden trellises on whitewashed, flaking walls. From the open windows of her sick room, a warm draught stirs the loose white hair at her neck, bringing scents of coal smoke, jasmine, opium. Her attention is fixed upon the sky, upon a silhouette of vast and irresistible grace, metal in her lifetime having taught itself to fly. In advance of that magnificence, tiny unmanned aeroplanes dip and skirl against the red horizon. Like starlings, Sybil thinks. The airship's lights, square golden windows, hint at human warmth. Effortlessly, with the incomparable grace of organic function, she imagines a distant music there, the music of London. The passengers promenade. They drink. They flirt. Perhaps they dance. Thoughts come unbidden, the mind weaving its perspectives, assembling meaning from emotion and memory. She recalls her life in London, recalls herself so long ago, making her way along the Strand, pressing past the crush at Temple Bar, pressing on, the city of memory winding itself about her, till, by the walls of Newgate, the shadow of her father's hanging falls. And memory turns, deflected, swift as light, down another byway, one where it is always evening. It is January 15th, 1855. A room in Grand's Hotel, Piccadilly. One chair was propped backward, wedged securely beneath the door's cut glass knob. Another was draped with clothing, a woman's fringed mantlet, a mud-crusted skirt of heavy worsted, a man's checked trousers and cutaway coat. Two forms lay beneath the bedclothes of the laminated maple four-poster, and off in the iron grip of winter, Big Ben bellowed 10 o'clock, great hoarse calliope sounds, the coal-fired breath of London. Sybil slid her feet through icy linens to the warmth of the ceramic bottle in its wrap of flannel. Her toes brushed his shin. The touch seemed to start him from deep deliberation. That was how he was, this dandy Mick Radley. She'd met Mick Radley at Laurent's Dancing Academy down Windmill Street. Now that she knew him, he seemed more the sort for Kellner's in Leicester Square, or even the Portland Rooms. He was always thinking, scheming, muttering over something in his head. Clever. Clever. It worried her, and Mrs. Winterhalter wouldn't have approved, for the handling of political gentlemen required delicacy and discretion, qualities Mrs. Winterhalter believed she herself had aplenty, while crediting none to her girls. "No more dolly-mopping, Sybil," Mick said. One of his pronouncements, something about which he'd made up his clever mind. Sybil grinned up at him, her face half hidden by the blanket's warm edge. She knew he liked the grin, her wicked girl grin. "He can't mean that," she thought. "Make a joke of it," she told herself. "But if I weren't a wicked dolly mop, would I be here with you now?"
"No more playing bobtail."
"You know I only go with gentlemen."
Mick sniffed, amused.
"Call me a gentleman, then."
"A very flash gentleman.
Sybil said, flattering him. "One of the fancy. You know I don't care for the rad lords. I spit on 'em, Mick." Sybil shivered, but not unhappily, for she'd run into a good bit of luck here. Full of steak and taters and hot chocolate, in bed between clean sheets in a fashionable hotel. A shiny new hotel, with central steam heat, though she'd gladly have traded the restless gurgling and banging of the scrolled gilt radiator for the glow of a well-banked hearth. And he was a good-looking cove, this Mick Radley, she had to admit. Dressed very flash, had the tin, and was generous with it, and he'd yet to demand anything peculiar or beastly. She knew it wouldn't last, as Mick was a touring gent from Manchester and gone soon enough, but there was profit in him, and maybe more when he left her, if she made him feel sorry about it, and generous. Mick reclined into fat feather pillows and slid his manicured fingers behind his spit-curled head. Silk nightshirt, all frothy with lace down the front, only the best for Mick. Now he seemed to want to talk a bit. Men did, usually, after a while. About their wives, mostly. But for Dandy Mick it was always politics. "So you hate the lordships, Sybil?"
"Why shouldn't I?" Sybil said. "I have my reasons."
"I should say you do," Mick said slowly. And the look he gave her then of cool superiority sent a shiver through her.
"What do you mean by that, Mick?"
"I know your reasons for hating the government. I have your number." Surprise seeped into her. Then fear. She sat up in bed. There was a taste in her mouth like cold iron. "You keep your card in your bag," he said. "I took that number to a Rome magistrate I know. He ran it through a government engine for me, and printed up your Bow Street file. Rat-a-tat-tat, like fun." He smirked. "So I know all about you, girl. Know who you are." She tried to put a bold face on it.
"And who's that, then, Mr. Radley?"
"No Sybil Jones, dearie. You're Sybil Gerard, the daughter of Walter Gerard, the Luddite agitator." He'd raided her hidden past. Machines whirring somewhere, spinning out history. Now Mick watched her face, smiling at what he saw there, and she recognized the look she'd seen before at Lorentz, when first he'd spied her across the crowded floor. A hungry look. Her voice shook.
"How long have you known about me?"
"Since our second night. You know I travel with the General. Like any important man, he has enemies. As his secretary and man of affairs, I take few chances with strangers." Mick put his cruel, deft little hand on her shoulder. "You might have been someone's agent. It was business." Sybil flinched away.
"Spying on a helpless girl," she said at last. "You're a right bastard, you are."
But her foul words scarcely seemed to touch him. He was cold and hard, like a judge or a lordship. "I may spy, girl, but I use the government's machinery for my own sweet purposes. I'm no copper's narc to look down my nose at a revolutionary like Walter Gerard, no matter what the radlords may call him now. Your father was a hero." He shifted on the pillow. "My hero? That was Walter Gerard. I saw him speak on the rights of labour in Manchester. He was a marvel. We all cheered till our throats was raw. The good old Hellcats!" Mick's smooth voice had gone sharp and flat in a Mancunian tang. "Ever hear tell of the Hellcats, Sybil, in the old days?"
"A street gang," Sybil said. "Rough boys in Manchester."
Mick frowned. "We was a brotherhood. A friendship youth guild. Your father knew us well. He was our patron politician, you might say."
"I'd prefer it if you didn't speak of my father, Mr. Radley."
Mick shook his head at her impatiently. "When I heard they'd tried and hanged him," the words like ice behind her ribs, "me and the lads, we took up torches and crowbars and we ran hot and wild. That was Ned Ludd's work, girl, years ago." He picked delicately at the front of his nightshirt. "'Tis not a tale I tell to many. The government's engines have long memories." She understood it now. Mick's generosity and his sweet talk, the strange hints he'd aimed at her of secret plans and better fortune, marked cards and hidden aces. He was pulling her strings, making her his creature. The daughter of Walter Gerard was a fancy prize for a man like Mick. She pulled herself out of bed, stepped across icy floorboards in her pantalettes and chemise. She dug quickly, silently, through the heap of her clothing, the fringed mantlet, the jacket, the great sagging cage of her crinoline skirt, the jingling white cuirass of her corset.
"Get back in bed," Mick said lazily. "Don't get your monkey up. 'Tis cold out there."
He shook his head.
"'Tis not like you think, Sybil."
She refused to look at him, struggling into her corset by the window where frost-caked glass cut the upwashed glare of gaslight from the street. She cinched the corset's laces tight across her back with a quick, practiced snap of her wrists.
"Or if it is," Mick mused, watching her, "'tis only in small degree."
Across the street, the opera had let out. Gentry in their cloaks and top hats. Cab horses, their backs in blankets, stamped and shivered on the black macadam. White traces of clean suburban snow still clung to the gleaming coachwork of some lordship's steam gurney. Tarts were working the crowd, poor wretched souls. Hard indeed to find a kind face amid those goffered shirts and diamond studs on such a cold night. Sybil turned toward Mick, confused, angry and very much afraid.
"Who did you tell about me?"
"Not a living soul," Mick said. "Not even my friend the General. And I won't be peaching on you. Nobody's ever said Mick Radley's indiscreet. So get back in bed."
"I shan't," Sybil said,
standing straight, her bare feet freezing on the floorboards.
"Sybil Jones may share your bed, but the daughter of Walter Gerard is a personage of substance."
Mick blinked at her, surprised. He thought it over, rubbing his narrow chin, then nodded.
"'Tis my sad loss, then, Miss Gerard."
He sat up in bed and pointed at the door, with a dramatic sweep of his arm. "Put on your skirt, then, and your brass-heeled dolly boots, Miss Gerard, and out the door with you and your substance.
But 'twould be a great shame if you left. I've uses for a clever girl."
"I should say you do, you blackguard," said Sybil.
But she hesitated. He had another card to play. She could sense it in the set of his face. He grinned at her, his eyes slitted.
"Have you ever been to Paris, Sybil?"
"Paris?"
Her breath clouded in mid-air.
"Yes," he said.
"The gay and the glamorous. Next destination for the General when his London lecture tour is done." Dandy Mick plucked at his lace cuffs. "What those uses are that I mentioned, I shan't as yet say. But the General is a man of deep stratagem, and the government of France have certain difficulties that require the help of experts." He leered triumphantly.
"But I can see that I bore you, eh?"
Sybil shifted from foot to foot.
"You'll take me to Paris, Mick," she said slowly. "And that's the true bill? No snicky humbugging?
Strictly square and level. If you don't believe me, I've a ticket in my coat for the Dover ferry."
Sybil walked to the brocade armchair in the corner and tugged at Mick's greatcoat. She shivered uncontrollably and slipped the greatcoat on. Fine, dark wool, like being wrapped in warm money.
"Try the right front pocket," Mick told her. "The card case."
He was amused and confident, as if it were funny that she didn't trust him. Sybil thrust her chilled hands into both pockets. Deep, plush-lined. Her left hand gripped a lump of hard, cold metal. She drew out a nasty little pepper-box derringer, ivory handle, intricate gleam of steel hammers and brass cartridges, small as her hand, but heavy.
"Naughty," said Mick, frowning. "Put it back, there's a girl."
Sybil put the thing away, gently but quickly, as if it were a live crab. In the other pocket she found his card case, red Morocco leather. Inside were business cards, carte de visite with his engine-stippled portrait, a London train timetable, and an engraved slip of stiff, creamy parchment, first-class passage on the Newcomen out of Dover.
"You'll need two tickets, then," she hesitated, "if you really mean to take me."
Mick nodded, conceding the point.
"And another for the train from Cherbourg, too. And nothing simpler. I can wire for tickets downstairs at the lobby desk."
Sybil shivered again and wrapped the coat closer. Mick laughed at her.
"Don't give me that vinegar fizz. You're still thinking like a dolly mop."
"Stop it,"
Start thinking flash, or you'll be of no use to me. You're Mick's gal now, a high flyer.
She spoke slowly, reluctantly. I've never been with any man who knew I was Sybil Gerard.
That was a lie, of course. There was Egremont, the man who had ruined her. Charles Egremont had known very well who she was. But Egremont no longer mattered. He lived in a different world now, with his po-faced, respectable wife and his respectable children and his respectable seat in Parliament. And Sybil hadn't been dolly-mopping with Egremont. Not exactly, anyway. A matter of degree. She could tell that Mick was pleased at the lie she'd told him. It had flattered him. Mick opened a gleaming cigar case, extracted a cheroot, and lit it in the oily flare of a repeating match, filling the room with the candied smell of cherry tobacco.
"So now you feel a bit shy with me, do you?" he said at last. "Well, I preferred it that way. What I know, that gives me a bit more grip on you, don't it, than mere tin?"
His eyes narrowed. "It's what a cove knows that counts, ain't it, Sybil? More than land or money, more than birth. Information. Very flash." Sybil felt a moment of hatred for him, for his ease and confidence. Pure resentment, sharp and primal, but she crushed her feelings down. The hatred wavered, losing its purity, turning to shame. She did hate him, but only because he truly knew her. He knew how far Sybil Gerard had fallen, that she had been an educated girl with airs and graces, as good as any gentry girl once. From the days of her father's fame, from her girlhood, Sybil could remember Mick Radley's like. She knew the kind of boy that he had been. Ragged, angry factory boys, penny a score, who would crowd her father after his torchlight speeches and do whatever he commanded. Rip up railroad tracks, kick the boiler plugs out of spinning jennies, lay policemen's helmets by his feet. She and her father had fled from town to town, often by night, living in cellars, attics, anonymous rooms to let, hiding from the rad police and the daggers of other conspirators. And sometimes, when his own wild speeches had filled him with a burning elation, her father would embrace her and soberly promise her the world. She would live like gentry in a green and quiet England when King Steam was wrecked, when Byron and his industrial radicals were utterly destroyed. But a hempen rope had choked her father into silence. The radicals ruled on and on, moving from triumph to triumph, shuffling the world like a deck of cards. And now Mick Radley was up in the world, and Sybil Gerard was down. She stood there silently, wrapped in Mick's coat. Paris. The promise tempted her, and when she let herself believe him, there was a thrill behind it like lightning. She forced herself to think about leaving her life in London. It was a bad, a low, a sordid life, she knew, but not entirely desperate. She still had things to lose. Her rented room in Whitechapel, and dear Toby, her cat. There was Mrs. Winterhalter, who arranged meetings between fast girls and political gentlemen. Mrs. Winterhalter was a bored, but ladylike and steady, and her sort was difficult to find. And she would lose her two steady gentlemen, Mr. Chadwick and Mr. Kingsley, who each saw her twice a month. Steady tin, that was, and kept her from the street. But Chadwick had a jealous wife in Fulham, and in a moment of foolishness, Sybil had stolen Kingsley's best cufflinks. She knew that he suspected. And neither man was half so free with his money as Dandy Mick. She forced herself to smile at him as sweetly as she could.
"You're a rum'un, Mick Radley. You know you've got my leading strings. Perhaps I was vexed with you at first, but I'm not so cakey as to not know a rum gentleman when I see one."
Mick blew smoke.
"You are a clever one," he said admiringly. "You talk blarney like an angel. You're not fooling me, though, so you needn't deceive yourself. Still, you're just the gal I need. Get back in bed."
She did as he told her.
"Jove," he said, "your blessed feet are two lumps of ice. Why don't you wear little slippers, eh?"
He tugged at her corset with determination.
"Slippers and black silk stockings," he said. "A gal looks very flash in bed with black silk stockings."
From the far end of the glass-topped counter, one of Aaron's shopmen gave Sybil the cold eye, standing haughty and tall in his neat black coat and polished boots. He knew something was up. He could smell it. Sybil waited for Mick to pay, hands folded before her on her skirt, demure, but watching sidelong from beneath the blue fringe of her bonnet. Under her skirt, wadded through the frame of her crinoline, was the shawl she'd nicked while Radley tried on top hats. Sybil had learnt how to nick things. She'd taught herself. It simply took nerve, that was the secret. It took pluck. Look neither right nor left, just grab, lift her skirt, stuff and rustle, then stand quite straight, with a psalm-singing look, like a gentry girl. The floorman had lost interest in her. He was watching a fat man fingering watered silk braces. Sybil checked her skirt quickly. No bulge showed. A young, spotty-faced clerk with ink-stained thumbs set Mick's number into a countertop credit machine. Zip, click, a pull on the ebony-handled lever, and it was done. He gave Mick his printed purchase slip and did the parcel up in string and crisp green paper. Aaron and son would never miss a cashmere shawl. Perhaps their account engines would, when they tallied up, but the loss couldn't hurt them. Their shopping palace was too big and too rich. All those Greek columns, chandeliers of Irish crystal, a million mirrors, room after gilded room, stuffed with rubber riding boots and French-milled soap, walking sticks, umbrellas, cutlery, locked glass cases crammed with silver plate and ivory brooches and lovely wind-up golden music boxes. And this was only one of a dozen in a chain. But for all that, she knew, Aaron's wasn't truly smart. Not a gentry place. But couldn't you just do anything with money in England, if you were clever? Some day Mr. Aaron, a whiskery old merchant Jew from Whitechapel, would have a lordship, with a steam gurney waiting at the curb and his own coat of arms on the coachwork. The Rad Parliament wouldn't care that Mr. Aaron was no Christian. They'd given Charles Darwin a lordship, and he said that Adam and Eve were monkeys. The liftman, gotten up in a Frenchified livery, drew the rattling brass gate aside for her. Mick followed her in, his parcel tucked under his arm, and then they were descending. They emerged from Aaron's into Whitechapel jostle. While Mick checked a street map he took from his coat, she gazed up at the shifting letters that ran the length of Aaron's frontage. A mechanical frieze, a slow sort of kinetrope for Aaron's adverts, made all of little bits of painted wood clicking about each in turn, behind leaded sheets of bevel glass. "Convert your manual piano," the jostling letters suggested, "into a Kastner's pianola." The skyline west of Whitechapel was spiky with construction cranes, stark steel skeletons painted with red lead against the damp. Older buildings were furred with scaffolding. What wasn't being torn down, it seemed, to make way for the new, was being rebuilt in its image. There was a distant huffing of excavation and a tremulous feeling below the pavement, of vast machines cutting some new underground line. But now Mick turned left without a word and walked away, his hat cocked to one side, his checkered trouser legs flashing under the long hem of his greatcoat. She had to hurry to match his step. A ragged boy with a numbered tin badge was sweeping mucky snow from the crossing. Mick tossed him a penny without breaking stride and headed down the lane called Butcher Row. She caught up and took his arm, past red and white carcasses dangling from their black iron hooks, beef and mutton and veal, and thick men in their stained aprons crying their goods. London women crowded there in scores, wicker baskets on their arms. Servants, cooks, respectable wives with men at home. A red-faced, squinting butcher lurched in front of Sybil with a double handful of blue meat. "Hello, pretty missus. Buy a gentleman my nice kidneys for pie." Sybil ducked her head and walked around him. Parked barrows crowded the curb where costers stood bellowing, their velveteen coats set off with buttons of brass or pearl. Each had his numbered badge, though fully half the numbers were slang, Mick claimed, as slang as the costers' weights and measures. There were blankets and baskets spread on neatly chalked squares on the paving, and Mick was telling her of ways the costers had to plump out shrunken fruit and weave dead eels in with live. She smiled at the pleasure he seemed to take in knowing such things, while hawkers yelped about their brooms and soap and candles, and a scowling organ grinder cranked two-handed at his symphony machine, filling the street with a fast, springy racket of bells, piano wire, and steel. Mick stopped beside a wooden trestle table, kept by a squint-eyed widow in bombazine, the stump of a clay pipe protruding from her thin lips. Arrayed before her were numerous vials of some viscous-looking substance Sybil took to be a patent medicine, for each was pasted with a blue slip of paper bearing the blurred image of a savage Red Indian. "What will this be, mother?" Mick inquired, tapping one red-waxed cork with a gloved finger.
"Rock oil, mister," she said, relinquishing the stem of her pipe. "Much as they call Barbados tar."
Her drawling accent grated on the ear, but Sybil felt a pang of pity. How far the woman was from whatever outlandish place she'd once called home.
"Really?" Mick asked. "It wouldn't be Texian." "Healthful balm," the widow said, "from nature's secret spring. The bloom of health and life to man will bring. Skimmed by the savage Seneca from the waters of Pennsylvania's great oil creek, mister. 3 pennies the vial and a guaranteed cure-all."
The woman was peering up at Mick now with a queer expression, her pale eyes screwed tight in nests of wrinkles, as though she might recall his face. Sybil shivered.
"Good day to you then, mother,"
Mick said, with a smile that somehow reminded Sybil of a vice detective she'd known, a sandy little man who worked Leicester Square and Soho. The Badger, the girls had called him.
"What is it?"
she asked, taking Mick's arm as he turned to go.
"What is it she's selling?"
"Rock oil," Mick said,
and she caught his sharp glance back at the hunched black figure.
"The general tells me it bubbles from the ground in Texas."
Sybil was curious.
"Is it a proper cure-all, then?"
"Never mind," he said, "and here's an end to chat."
He was glancing bright-eyed down the lane.
"I see one, and you know what to do."
Sybil nodded, and began to pick her way through the market crowd toward the man Mick had seen. He was a ballad seller, lean and hollow-cheeked, his hair long and greasy under a tall hat wrapped in bright polka-dot fabric. He held both his arms bent, hands knotted as if in prayer, the sleeves of his rumpled jacket heavy with long, rustling choirs of sheet music.
"Railway to heaven, ladies and gents,"
the ballad seller chanted, a veteran patterer.
"Of truth divine the rails are made, and on the rock of ages laid. The rails are fixed in chains of love, firm as the throne of God above. Lovely tune, and only tuppence, miss."
"Do you have the Raven of San Jacinto?" Sybil asked.
"I can get that, I can get it," the seller said.
"And what's that, then?" "About the great battle in Texas. The great general?"
The ballad seller arched his brows. His eyes were blue and crazily bright, with hunger, perhaps, or religion. Or gin.
"One of your Crimea generals, then? A Frenchie, this Mr. Jacinto?"
"No, no," Sybil said, and gave him a pitying smile. "General Houston, Sam Houston of Texas. I do want that song most particular."
"I buy my publications fresh this afternoon, and I'll look for your song for you, sure, miss."
"I shall want at least 5 copies for my friends," Sybil said.
10 pence will get you 6.
6, then, and this afternoon at this very spot."
"Just as you say, miss."
The seller touched the brim of his hat. Sybil walked away into the crowd. She had done it. It was not so bad. She felt she could get used to it. Perhaps it was a good tune, too, one that people would enjoy when the ballad man was forced to sell the copies. Mick sidled up suddenly at her elbow.
"Not bad," Mick allowed, reaching into the pocket of his greatcoat, like magic to produce an apple turnover, still hot, flaking sugar and wrapped in greasy paper.
"Thank you," she said, startled but glad, for she'd been thinking of stopping, hiding, fetching out the stolen shawl.
But Mick's eyes had been on her every moment. She hadn't seen him, but he'd been watching. That was the way he was. She wouldn't forget again. They walked, together and apart, all down Somerset, and then through the vast market of Petticoat Lane, lit as evening drew on with a host of lights, a glow of gas mantles, the white glare of carbide, filthy grease lamps, tallow dips twinkling among the foodstuffs proffered from the stalls. The hubbub was deafening here, but she delighted Mick by gulling 3 more ballad sellers. In a great, bright, Whitechapel gin palace, with glittering gold-papered walls flaring with fish-tail gas jets, Sybil excused herself and found a lady's convenience. There, safe within a reeking stall, she fetched the shawl out. So soft it was. And such a lovely violet colour, too, one of the strange new dyes clever people made from coal. She folded the shawl neatly and stuffed it through the top of her corset so it rested safe, then out to join her keeper again, finding him seated at a table. He'd bought her a noggin of honey gin. She sat beside him. "You did well, girl," he said, and slid the little glass toward her. The place was full of Crimean soldiers on furlough, Irishmen, with street drabs hanging on them, growing red-nosed and screechy on gin. No barmaids here, but big, bruiser, bully rock bartenders in white aprons, with mill-knocker clubs behind the bar. "Gin's a whore's drink, Mick. Everybody likes gin," he said, "and you're no whore, Sybil." "Dolly Mop, Bobtail." She looked at him sharply. "What else do you call me, then?"
"You're with Dandy Mick now," he said.
He leaned his chair back, jabbing his gloved thumbs through the armholes of his waistcoat.
"You're an adventuress."
"Adventuress?"
"Bloody right," he straightened. "And here's to you."
He sipped his gin twist, rolled it over his tongue with an unhappy look, and swallowed.
"Never mind, dear. They've cut this with turpentine, or I'm a Jew."
He stood up. They left. She hung on his arm, trying to slow his pace.
"Adventurer. That's what you are then, eh, Mr. Mick Radley?"
"So I am, Sybil," he said softly, "and you're to be my apprentice. So you do as you're told in the proper humble spirit, learn the tricks of craft, and some day you join the union, eh? The guild."
"Like my father, eh? You want to make a play of that, Mick? Who he was? Who I am?"
"No," Mick said flatly. "He was old-fashioned. He's nobody now." Sybil smirked.
"They let us wicked girls into this fancy guild of yours, do they, Mick?"
"It's a knowledge guild," he said soberly. "The bosses, the biggins, they can take all manner of things away from us, with their bloody laws and factories and courts and banks. They can make the world to their pleasure. They can take away your home and kin and even the work you do."
Mick shrugged angrily, his lean shoulders denting the heavy fabric of the greatcoat. "And even rob a hero's daughter of her virtue, if I'm not too bold in speaking of it." He pressed her hand against his sleeve, a hard, trapping grip.
"But they can't ever take what you know. Now can they, Sybil? They can't ever take that."
Sybil heard Hetty's footsteps in the hall outside her room and the rattle of Hetty's key at the door. She let the serenade die down with a high-pitched drone. Hetty tugged the snow-flaked woollen bonnet from her head, shrugging free from her navy cloak. She was another of Mrs. Winterhalter's girls, a big-boned, raucous brunette from Devon, who drank too much but was sweet in her way and always kind to Toby. Sybil folded away the china-handled crank and lowered the cheap instrument's scratched lid.
"I was practicing. Mrs. Winterhalter wants me to sing next Thursday." "Bother the old drab," Hetty said. "Thought this was your night out with Mr. C. Or is it Mr. K?"
Hetty stamped warmth into her feet before the narrow little hearth, then noticed in the lamplight the scattering of shoes and hat boxes from Aaron and Son.
"My word," she said,
and smiled, her broad mouth pinched a bit with envy.
"New beau, is it? You're so lucky, Sybil Jones."
"Perhaps." Sybil sipped hot lemon cordial, tilting her head back to relax her throat. Hetty winked.
"Winterhalter doesn't know about this one, eh?"
Sybil shook her head and smiled. Hetty would not tell.
"Do you know anything about Texas, Hetty?"
"A country in America," Hetty said readily.
"French own it, don't they? That's Mexico. Would you like to go to a kinotrope show, Hetty? The former president of Texas is lecturing. I've tickets. Free for the taking."
"When?"
"Saturday."
"I'm dancing then," Hetty said.
"Perhaps Mandy would go."
She blew warmth into her fingers.
"Friend of mine comes by late tonight. Wouldn't trouble you, would it?"
"No,"
Sybil said. Mrs. Winterhalter had a strict rule against any girl keeping company with men in her room. It was a rule Hetty often ignored, as if daring the landlord to peach on her. Since Mrs. Winterhalter chose to pay the rent directly to the landlord, Mr. Cairns, Sybil seldom had call to speak to him, and less with his sullen wife, a thick-ankled woman with a taste for dreadful hats. Cairns and his wife had never informed against Hetty, though Sybil was not sure why, for Hetty's room was next to theirs, and Hetty made a shameless racket when she brought men home,
foreign diplomats mostly, men with odd accents and, to judge by the noise, beastly habits.
"You can carry on singing if you like," Hetty said, and knelt before the ash-covered fire. "You've a fine voice. Mustn't let your gifts go to waste."
She began to feed individual coals to the hearth, shivering. A dire chill seemed to enter the room then, through the cracked casement of one of the nailed-up windows, and for a strange passing moment Sybil felt a distinct presence in the air, a definite sense of observation, of eyes fixed upon her from another realm. She thought of her dead father.
"Learn the voice, Sybil. Learn to speak. It's all we have that can fight them," he had told her.
This in the last few days before his arrest, when it was clear that the Rads had won again, clear to everyone, perhaps, save Walter Gerard. She had seen then, with heart-crushing clarity, the utter magnitude of her father's defeat. His ideals would be lost, not just misplaced, but utterly expunged from history, to be crushed again and again and again, like the carcass of a mongrel dog under the racketing wheels of an express train.
"Learn to speak, Sybil. It's all we have."
"Read to me?" Hetty asked. "I'll make tea."
"Very well." In her spotty, scattered life with Hetty, reading aloud was one of the little rituals they had that passed for domesticity. Sybil took up the day's illustrated London news from the deal table, settled her crinoline about her in the creaking, damp-smelling armchair, and squinted at a front-page article. It concerned itself with dinosaurs. The Rads were mad for these dinosaurs, it seemed. Here was an engraving of a party of seven, led by Lord Darwin, all peering intently at some indeterminate object embedded in a coalface in Thuringia. Sybil read the caption aloud, showed the picture to Hetty. A bone. The thing in the coal was a monstrous bone, as long as a man was tall. She shuddered. Turning the page, she encountered an artist's view of the creature as it might have looked in life— a monstrosity with twin rows of angry, triangular, saw teeth along its humped spine. It seemed the size of an elephant, at least, though its evil little head was scarcely larger than a hound's. Hetty poured the tea.
"Reptiles held sway across the whole of the earth, eh?" she quoted, and threaded her needle. "I don't believe a bloody word of it."
"Why not?
They're the bones of bloody giants, out of Genesis. That's what the clergy say, ain't it?"
Sybil said nothing. Neither supposition struck her as the more fantastic. She turned to a second article, this one in praise of Her Majesty's artillery in the Crimea. She found an engraving of two handsome subalterns admiring the operation of a long-range gun. The gun itself, its barrel stout as a foundry stack, looked fit to make short work of all Lord Darwin's dinosaurs. Sybil's attention, however, was held by an inset view of the gunnery engine. The intricate nest of interlocking gearwork possessed a queer beauty, like some kind of baroquely fabulous wallpaper.
"Have you anything that needs darning?" Hetty asked.
"No, thank you."
"Read some adverts, then," Hetty advised. "I do hate that war humbug."
There was Haviland China from Limoges, France, Vin Mariani, the French tonic, with a testimonial from Alexandre Dumas, and descriptive book, portraits and autographs of celebrities, upon application to the premises in Oxford Street. Silver electro-silicon polish. It never scratches, never wears. It is unlike others. The new departure bicycle bell. It has a tone all its own. Dr. Bailey's lithia water cures Bright's disease and the gouty diathesis. Gurney's Regent pocket steam engine intended for use with domestic sewing machines. This last held Sybil's attention, but not through its promise to operate a machine at double the old speed at a cost of one halfpenny per hour. Here was an engraving of the tastefully ornamented little boiler, to be heated by gas or paraffin. Charles Egremont had purchased one of these for his wife. It came equipped with a rubber tube, intended to vent the waste steam when jammed under a convenient sash window. But Sybil had been delighted to hear that it had turned Madame's drawing-room into a Turkish bath. When the paper was finished, Sybil went to bed. She was woken around midnight by the savage, rhythmic crunching of Hetty's bedsprings. It was dim in the Garrick Theatre, dusty and cold, with the pit and the balcony and the racks of shabby seats, but it was pitch dark below the stage where Mick Radley was, and it smelled of damp and lime. Mick's voice echoed up from under her feet. "Ever seen the innards of a kinotrope, Sybil?"
"I saw one once, backstage," she said, "at a music hall in Bethnal Green. I knew the fellow what worked it, a clacker cove."
"A sweetheart?" Mick asked. His echoing voice was sharp.
"No," Sybil told him quickly. "I was singing a bit, but it scarcely paid."
She heard the sharp click of his repeating match. It caught on the third attempt, and he lit a stub of candle.
"Come down," he commanded. "Don't stand there like a goose showing off your ankles."
Sybil lifted her crinoline with both hands and picked her way uneasily down the steep, damp stairs. Mick reached up to grope behind a tall stage mirror, a great gleaming sheet of silvered glass, with a wheeled pedestal and oily gears and worn wooden cranks. He retrieved a cheap black portmanteau of proofed canvas, placed it carefully on the floor before him, and squatted to undo the flimsy tin clasps. He removed a stack of perforated cards bound with a ribbon of red paper. There were other bundles in the bag as well, Sybil saw, and something else, a gleam of polished wood. He handled the cards gently, like a Bible.
"Safe as houses," he said. "You just disguise 'em, you see. Write something stupid on the wrapper like, 'Temperance Lecture, Parts 1, 2, 3. Then coves never think to steal 'em, or even load them up and look."
Hefting the thick block, he riffled its edge with his thumb so that it made a sharp, crisp sound like a gambler's new deck.
"I put a deal of capital in these," he said. "Weeks of work from the best keno hands in Manchester. Exclusive to my design, I might point out. 'Tis a lovely thing, girl. Quite artistic in its way."
"You'll soon see." Closing the portmanteau, he stood. He carefully slid the bundle of cards into his coat pocket, then bent over a crate and tugged out a thick glass tube. He blew dust from the tube, then gripped one end of it with a special pair of pincers. The glass cracked open with an airtight pop. There was a fresh block of lime in the tube. Mick slid it loose, humming to himself. He tapped the lime gently into the socket of a limelight burner, a great dish-shaped thing of sooty iron and gleaming tin. Then he turned a hose tap, sniffed a bit, nodded, turned a second tap, and set the candle to it. Sybil yelped as a vicious flash sheeted into her eyes. Mick chuckled at her over the hiss of blazing gas, dots of hot, blue dazzle drifting before her.
"Better," he remarked.
He aimed the blazing limelight carefully into the stage mirror, then began to adjust its cranks. Sybil looked around, blinking. It was dank and ratty and cramped under the Garrick stage, the sort of place a dog or a pauper might die in, with torn and yellowed bills underfoot for naughty farces like "That Rascal Jack" and "Scamps of London." A pair of ladies' unmentionables were wadded in a corner. From her brief, unhappy days as a stage singer, she had some idea how they might have gotten there. She let her gaze follow steam pipes and taut wires to the gleam of the Babbage engine, a small one, a kinotrope model no taller than Sybil herself. Unlike everything else in the Garrick, the engine looked in very good repair, mounted on 4 mahogany blocks. The floor and ceiling above and beneath it had been carefully scoured and whitewashed. Steam calculators were delicate things, temperamental, so she'd heard. Better not to own one than not cherish it. In the stray glare from Mick's limelight, dozens of knobbed brass columns gleamed, set top and bottom into solid sockets bored through polished plates with shining levers, ratchets, 1,000 steel gears cut bright and fine. It smelled of linseed oil. Looking at it, this close, this long, made Sybil feel quite odd. Hungry, almost, or greedy in a queer way, the way she might feel about a fine lovely horse, say. She wanted not to own it exactly, but possess it somehow. Mick took her elbow suddenly from behind. She started.
"Lovely thing, isn't it?"
"Yes, it's lovely."
Mick still held her arm. Slowly he put his other gloved hand against her cheek inside her bonnet. Then he lifted her chin with his thumb, stared into her face.
"It makes you feel something, doesn't it?"
His rapt voice frightened her, his eyes underlit with glare.
"Yes, Mick," she said obediently, quickly. "I do feel it. Something."
He tugged her bonnet loose to hang at her neck.
"You're not frightened of it, Sybil, are you? Not with Dandy Mick here holding you. You feel a little special frisson. You'll learn to like that feeling.
We'll make a clacker of you.
Can I do that? Truly, can a girl do that?
Mick laughed.
Have you never heard of Lady Ada Byron, then? The Prime Minister's daughter and the very Queen of Engines.
He let her go and swung both his arms wide, coat swinging open, a showman's gesture.
Ada Byron, true friend and disciple of Babbage himself, Lord Charles Babbage, father of the difference engine and the Newton of our modern age.
She gaped at him.
But Ada Byron is a ladyship.
You'll be surprised who our Lady Ada knows, Mick declared, plucking a block of cards from his pocket and peeling off its paper jacket.
Oh, not to drink tea with among the diamond squad at her garden parties, but Ada's what you'd call fast in her own mathematical way.
He paused.
That's not to say that Ada is the best, you know. I know clacking coves in the Steam Intellect Society that make even Lady Ada look a bit tardy, but Ada possesses genius. Do you know what that means, Sybil, to possess genius?
What? Sybil said, hating the giddy surety in his voice.
Do you know how analytical geometry was born? Fellow named Descartes, watching a fly on the ceiling. A million fellows before him had watched flies on the ceiling, but it took René Descartes to make a science of it. Now engineers use what he discovered every day, but if it weren't for him, we'd still be blind to it.
What do flies matter to anyone? Sybil demanded.
Ada had an insight once that ranked with Descartes' discovery. No one has found a use for it as yet. It's what they call pure mathematics,
Mick laughed.
Pure. You know what that means, Sybil? It means they can't get it to run.
He rubbed his hands together, grinning.
No one can get it to run.
Mick's glee was wearing at her nerves.
I thought you hated lordships. I do hate lordly privilege. What's not earned fair and square and level, he said. But Lady Ada lives and swears by the power of the grey matter, and not her blue blood.
He slotted the cards into a silvered tray by the side of the machine, then spun and caught her wrist.
Your father's dead, girl. 'Tis not that I mean to hurt you, saying it, but the Luddites are dead as cold ashes. Oh, we marched and ranted for the rights of labour and such. Fine talk, girl. But Lord Charles Babbage made blueprints while we made pamphlets. And his blueprints built this world.
Mick shook his head.
The Byron men, the Babbage men, the industrial radicals, they own Great Britain. They own us, girl. The very globe is at their feet. Europe, America, everywhere. The House of Lords is packed top to bottom with rads. Queen Victoria won't stir a finger without a nod from the savants and capitalists.
He pointed at her.
And it's no use fighting that any more. And you know why? Because the rads do play fair, or fair enough to manage, and you can become one of them, if you're clever. You can't get clever men to fight such a system as it makes too much sense to them.
Mick thumbed his chest.
But that don't mean that you and I are out in the cold and lonely. It only means we have to think faster, with our eyes peeled and our ears open.
Mick struck a prize-fighter's pose, elbows bent, fists poised, knuckles up before his face. Then he flung his hair back and grinned at her.
"That's all very well for you,"
Sybil protested.
"You can do as you like. You were one of my father's followers. Well, there were many such, and some are in Parliament now. But fallen women get ruined, do you see? Ruined and stay that way."
Mick straightened, frowning at her.
"Now that's exactly what I mean. You're running with a flash mob now, but thinking like a trollop. There's no one knows who you are in Paris. The cops and bosses have your number here, true enough, but numbers are only that, and your file's no more than a simple stack of cards. For them as know, there's ways to change a number."
He sneered, to see her surprise.
"It ain't done easy here in London, I grant you. But affairs run differently in the Paris of Louis Napoleon. Affairs run fast and loose in Flash Paris, especially for an adventuress with a blarney tongue and a pretty ankle."
Sybil bit her knuckle. Her eyes burned suddenly. It was acrid smoke from the limelight and fear. A new number in the government's machines, that would mean a new life, a life without a past. The unexpected thought of such freedom terrified her. Not so much for what it meant in itself, though that was strange and dazzling enough, but for what Mick Radley might demand for such a thing in fair exchange.
"Truly, could you change my number?" "I can buy you a new one in Paris, pass you off for French, or an Argy or an American refugee girl."
Mick folded his elegant arms.
I promise nothing, mind you. You'll have to earn it.
You wouldn't gull me, Mick, she said slowly, because I could be really and specially sweet to a fellow who could do me such a great service.
Mick jammed his hands in his pockets, rocking back on his heels, looking at her.
Could you now? He said softly.
Her trembling words had fanned something inside him. She could see it in his eyes. An eager, lustful kindling, something she dimly knew was there, a need he had to slip his fish hooks deeper into her.
I could, if you treated me fair and level as your prentice adventuress and not some cakey dolly mop to gull and cast aside.
Sybil felt tears coming, harder this time. She blinked and looked up boldly and let them flow, thinking perhaps they might do some good.
You wouldn't raise my hopes and dash them, would you? That would be low and cruel. If you did that, I'd jump off Tower Bridge.
He looked her in the eye.
Bah, that sniffling girl, and listen close to me. Understand this? You're not just Mick's pretty bit of muslin. I may have a taste for that same as any man, but I can get that where I like, and don't need you just for that. I need the blarney skill and the daring pluck that was Mr. Walter Gerard's. You ought to be my prentice, Sybil, and I your master, and let that be how things stand with us. You'll be loyal, obedient, truthful to me, no subterfuge and no impertinence, and in return I'll teach you craft and keep you well. And you'll find me as kind and generous as you are loyal and true. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, Mick.
We have a pact, then?
Yes, Mick.
She smiled at him.
Well and good, he said. Then kneel, here, and put your hands together. So,
he joined his hands in prayer,
and make this oath, that you, Sybil Gerard, do swear by saints and angels, by powers, dominions and thrones, by seraphim and cherubim, and the all-seeing eye, to obey Michael Radley, and serve him faithfully, so help you God. Do you so swear?
She stared at him in dismay.
Must I really?
Yes.
But isn't it a great sin to make such an oath to a man who... I mean to say, we're not in holy wedlock.
That's a marriage vow, he said impatiently, and this apprentice oath.
She saw no alternative. Tugging her skirts back, she knelt before him on cold, gritty stone.
Do you so swear?
I do. So help me God.
Don't look so glum, he said, helping her to her feet. That's a mild and womanly oath you swore compared to some.
He pulled her to her feet.
Let it brace you, should you have doubts or disloyal thoughts. Now, take this.
He handed her the guttering candle.
And hunt up that gin-soak of a stage manager, and tell him I want the boilers fired.
They dined that evening in the Argyle Rooms, a Haymarket resort not far from Laurent's Dancing Academy. The Argyle had private supper rooms in which the indiscreet might spend an entire night. Sybil was mystified by the choice of a private room. Mick was certainly not ashamed to be seen with her in public. Midway through the lamb, however, the waiter admitted a stout little gentleman with pomaded red hair and a gold chain across a taut velvet waistcoat. He was round and plush as a child's doll.
"Hello, Corny," Mick said, without bothering to put down his knife and fork.
"Evening, Mick,"
the man said, with a curiously unplaceable accent of an actor, or a provincial long in service to city gentry.
"I was told you'd need of me."
"And told correctly, Corny,"
Mick neither offered to introduce Sybil nor asked the man to sit. She began to feel quite uncomfortable.
"'Tis a brief part, so you should have little trouble remembering your lines."
Mick produced a plain envelope from his coat and handed it to the man.
"Your lines, your cue, and your retainer. The Garrick, Saturday night."
The man smiled mirthlessly as he accepted the envelope.
"Quite some time since I played the Garrick, Mick."
He winked at Sybil and took his leave, with no more formality than that.
"Who's that, Mick?"
Sybil asked. Mick had returned to his lamb and was spooning mint sauce from a pewter serving pot.
"An actor of parts," Mick said. "He'll play opposite you in the Garrick during Houston's speech."
Sybil was baffled.
"Play? Opposite me?"
"You're apprentice adventuress, don't forget. You can expect to be called on to play many roles, Sybil.
A political speech can always benefit from a bit of sweetening.
Sweetening?
Never mind. He seemed to lose interest in his lamb and pushed his plate aside. Plenty of time for rehearsal tomorrow. I've something to show you now. He rose from the table, crossed to the door and bolted it securely. Returning, he lifted the proofed canvas portmanteau from the carpet beside his chair and placed it before her on the Argyle's clean but much mended linen. She'd been curious about the portmanteau. Not curious that he'd carried it with him from the Garrick's pit, first to the printer's, to examine the handbills for Houston's lecture, then on to the Argyle rooms, but because it was of such cheap stuff, nothing at all like the gear he so obviously prided himself on. Why should Dandy Mick choose to carry about a bag of that sort, when he could afford some flash confection from Aaron's, nickel clasps and silk woven in Ada checkers? And she knew that the black bag no longer contained the keynote cards for the lecture, because he'd wrapped those carefully in sheets of The Times and hidden them again behind the stage mirror. Mick undid the wretched tin clasps, opened the bag, and lifted out a long narrow case of polished rosewood, its corners trimmed with bright brass. Sybil wondered if it mightn't contain a telescope, for she'd seen boxes of this sort in the window of a firm of Oxford Street instrument makers. Mick handled it with a caution that was very nearly comical, like some papist called upon to move the dust of a dead pope. Caught up in a sudden mood of childlike anticipation, she forgot the man called Corney and Mick's worrying talk about playing opposite him at the Garrick. There was something of the magician about Mick now, as he placed the gleaming rosewood case on the tablecloth. She almost expected him to furl back his cuffs. Nothing here, you see, nothing here. His thumbs swung tiny brass hooks from a pair of miniature eyelets. He paused for effect. Sybil found that she was holding her breath. Had he brought a gift for her? Some token of her new status? Something to secretly mark her as his prentice adventuress? Mick lifted the rosewood lid with its sharp brass corners. It was filled with playing cards, stuffed end to end with them, a score of decks at the least. Sybil's heart fell.
"You've seen nothing like this before," he said. "I can assure you of that."
Mick pinched out the card nearest his right hand and displayed it for her. No, not a playing card, though near enough in size. It was made of some strange milky substance that was neither paper nor glass, very thin and glossy. Mick flexed it lightly between thumb and forefinger. It bent easily, but sprang rigid again as he released it. It was perforated with perhaps 36 tightly spaced rows of circular holes, holes no larger than those in a good pearl button. Three of its corners were slightly rounded, while the fourth was trimmed off at an angle. Near the trimmed corner someone had written, "Number 1," in faint mauve ink.
"Camphorated cellulose," Mick declared. "The devil's own stuff should it touch fire. But naught else will serve the finer functions of the Napoleon."
Napoleon? Sybil was lost.
"Is it a sort of keynote card, Mick?"
He beamed at her, delighted. She seemed to have said the right thing.
"Have you never heard of the great Napoleon Ordinateur, the mightiest engine of the French Academy? The London police engines are mere toys beside it."
Sybil pretended to study the contents of the box, knowing it would please Mick. But it was merely a wooden box, quite handsomely made, lined with the green baize that covered billiard tables. It contained a very large quantity of the slick, milky cards. Perhaps several hundred.
"Tell me what this is about, Mick."
He laughed, quite happily it seemed, and bent suddenly to kiss her mouth.
"In time, in time."
He straightened, reinserted the card, lowered the lid, clicked the brass hooks into place.
"Every brotherhood has its mysteries. Dandy Mick's best guess is that nobody knows quite what it would mean to run this little stack. It would demonstrate a certain matter, prove a certain nested series of mathematical hypotheses, all matters quite arcane. And, by the by, it would make the name of Michael Radley shine like the very heavens in the clacking confraternity."
He winked.
"The French clackers have their own brotherhoods, you know. Les Filles de Vaucanson, they call themselves. The Jacquardine Society. We'll be showing those onion eaters a thing or two."
He seemed drunk to her now, though she knew he'd only had those two bottled ales. No, he was intoxicated by the idea of the cards in the box, whatever they might be.
This box and its contents are quite extraordinarily dear, Sybil.
He seated himself again and rummaged in the cheap black bag. It yielded a folded sheet of stout brown paper, an ordinary pair of stationary shears, a roll of strong green twine. As Mick spoke, he unfolded the paper and began to wrap the box in it.
Very dear. Travelling with a general exposes a man to certain dangers. We're off to Paris after the lecture, but tomorrow morning you'll be taking this round to the post office in Great Portland Street.
Done with wrapping, he wound twine about the paper.
Nip this for me with the shears.
She did as he asked.
Now put your finger here.
He executed a perfect knot.
You'll be posting our parcel to Paris. Poste restante. Do you know what that means?
It means the parcel is held for the addressee.
Mick nodded, took a stick of scarlet sealing wax from one trouser pocket, his repeating match from the other. The match struck on the first try.
Yes, held there in Paris for us, safe as houses.
The wax darkened and slid in the oily flame. Scarlet droplets spattered the green knot, the brown paper. He tossed the shears and the roll of twine back into the portmanteau, pocketed the wax and the match, withdrew his reservoir pen, and began to address the parcel.
But what is it, Mick? How can you know its value if you've no idea what it does?
Now, I didn't say that, did I? I've my ideas, don't I? Dandy Mick always has his ideas. I'd enough of an idea to take the original up to Manchester with me on the General's business. I'd enough of an idea to pump the canniest clackers for their latest compression techniques, and enough of the General's capital to commission the result on Napoleon gauge cellulose.
It might have been Greek, for all it meant to her. A knock came. An evil-looking servant boy, crop-headed and snuffling, wheeled in a trolley and cleared the plates. He made a botch of it, lingering as if expecting a gratuity, but Mick ignored him and stared coolly into space, now and then grinning to himself like a cat. The boy left with a sneer. At length there came the rap of a cane against the door. A second of Mick's friends had arrived. This was a heavy-set man of quite astonishing ugliness, pop-eyed and blue-jowled, his squat, sloping forehead fringed in an oiled parody of the elegant spit-curls the Prime Minister favoured. The stranger wore new and well-cut evening dress, with cloak, cane, and top hat, a fancy pearl in his cravat, and a gold Masonic ring on one finger. His face and neck were deeply sunburnt. Mick rose at once from his chair, shook the ringed hand, offered a seat.
"You keep late hours, Mr. Radley,"
the stranger said.
"We do what we can to accommodate your special needs, Professor Rodwick."
The ugly gentleman settled in his chair with a sharp wooden squeak. His bulging eyes shot Sybil a speculative look, then, and for one heart-leaping moment she feared the worst, that it had all been a gull and she was about to become part of some dreadful transaction between them. But Rodwick looked away to Mick.
"I won't conceal from you, sir, my eagerness to resume my activities in Texas."
He pursed his lips. He had small, greyish, pebble-like teeth and a great slash of a mouth.
"This business of playing the London social lion is a deuced bore."
"President Houston will grant you an audience tomorrow at 2, if that's agreeable."
Rodwick grunted.
"Perfectly."
Mick nodded.
"The fame of your Texian discovery seems to grow by the day, sir. I understand that Lord Babbage himself has taken an interest."
"We have worked together at the Institute at Cambridge,"
Rodwick admitted, unable to hide a smirk of satisfaction.
"The theory of pneumodynamics."
"As it happens," Mick remarked, "I find myself in possession of a clacking sequence that may amuse his lordship."
Rodwick seemed nettled by this news.
"Amuse him, sir? Lord Babbage is a most irascible man."
"Lady Ada was kind enough to favour me in my initial efforts."
"Favour you?"
said Rodwick, with a sudden ugly laugh.
"Is it some gambling system, then? It had best be, if you hope to catch her eye."
"Not at all," Mick said shortly.
"Her ladyship chooses odd friends,"
Rodwick opined, with a long, sullen look at Mick.
"Do you know a man named Collins, the so-called odds-maker?"
"Haven't had the pleasure," Mick said.
"The fellow's on her like a louse in a bitch's ear,"
Rodwick said, his sunburnt face flushing.
"Fellow made me the most astounding proposition."
"And?" Mick said delicately. Rodwick frowned.
"I did fancy you might know him.
"'He seems the sort that might well run in your circles.'
"'No, sir.' Radwick leaned forward.
"'And what of another certain gent, Mr. Radley, "'very long of limb and cold of eye, "'who I fancy has been dogging my movements of late? "'Would he, perhaps, be an agent of your President Houston? "'Seemed to have a Texian air about him?'
"'My President is fortunate in the quality of his agents.' Radwick stood, his face dark.
"'You'll be so kind, I'm sure, as to request the bastard to cease and desist.'
Mick rose as well, smiling sweetly. "'I'll certainly convey your sentiments to my employer, Professor, but I fear I keep you from your night's amusements.' He walked to the door, opened it, shut it on Radwick's broad, well-tailored back. Mick turned, winked at Sybil. "'He's off to the ratting pits.' A very low sporting gentleman, our learned Professor Rudwick. Speaks his bloody mind, though, don't he? He paused. The General will like him. Hours later she woke in Grand's, in bed beside him, to the click of his match and the sweet reek of his cigar. He'd had her twice on the chaise behind their table in the Argyle rooms, and once again in Grand's. She'd not known him to be so ardent before. She'd found it encouraging, though the third go had made her sore, down there. The room was dark, save for the spill of gaslight past the curtains. She moved a bit closer to him.
"'Where would you like to go, Sybil? After France?'
She'd never considered the question.
"'With you, Mick?'
He chuckled and slid his hand beneath the bedclothes. His fingers closed around the mound of her womanhood.
"'Where shall we go, then, Mick?'
Go with me and you go first to Mexico, then north for the liberation of Texas with a Franco-Mexican army under the command of General Houston.
But isn't Texas a frightfully queer place?
Quit thinking like a Whitechapel drab. All the world's queer seen from Piccadilly. Sam Houston had himself a bloody palace in Texas. Before the Texians threw him into exile, he was Britain's greatest ally in the American West. You and I... Why, we could live like grandees in Texas, build a manor by some river.
Would they truly let us do that, Mick?
Her Majesty's government, you mean? Perfidious Albion?
Mick chuckled.
Well, that largely depends on British public opinion toward General Houston. We're doing all we can to sweeten his reputation here in Britain. That's why he's on this lecture tour, isn't it?
I see, Sybil said. You're very clever, Mick.
Deep matters, Sybil. Balance of power. It worked for Britain in Europe for 500 years, and it works even better in America. Union, Confederacy, Republics of Texas and California, they all take a turn in British favour until they get too bold, a bit too independent, and then they're taken down a peg. Divide and rule, dear.
The coal end of Mick's cigar glowed in the darkness.
If it weren't for British diplomacy, British power, America might be all one huge nation.
"'What about your friend, the General? Will he truly help us?'
"'That's the beauty of it,' Mick declared. "'The diplomats thought Sam Houston was a bit stiff-necked, "'didn't care for some of his actions and policies, "'didn't back him as strongly as they should have. "'But the Texian junta that replaced him is far worse. "'They're openly hostile to British interests. "'Their days are numbered. "'The General has had to cool his heels a bit in exile here in England, "'but now he's on his way back to Texas, for what's his?' By right.
He shrugged.
Should have happened years ago. Our trouble is that Her Majesty's government don't know their own mind. There's factions among them. Some don't trust Sam Houston. But the French will help us anyhow. Their Mexican clients have a border war with the Texians. They need the General.
You're going to war then, Mick?
She found it difficult to imagine Dandy Mick leading a cavalry charge.
Coup d'etat. More like, he assured her. We won't see much bloodshed. I'm Houston's political man, you see, and his man I'll stay, for I'm the ones arranged this London speaking tour, and on to France, and I'm the ones made certain approaches as resulted in him being granted his audience with the French Emperor.
But could that be true?
Really?
And I'm the one as runs Manchester's newest and best, through the Keno for him, "'sweetens the press and British public opinion, hires the bill stickers.'
"'He drew on his cigar, his fingers kneading her there, "'and she heard him puff out a great satisfied cloud of cherry smoke.
But he mustn't have felt like doing it again, not then, because she was soon asleep and dreaming. Dreaming of Texas. A Texas of rolling downs, contented sheep, the windows of grey manors glinting in late afternoon sunlight. Sybil sat in an aisle seat, third row back in the Garrick, thinking unhappily that General Sam Houston, late of Texas, was not drawing much of a crowd. People were filtering in as the five-man orchestra squeaked and soared and honked. A family party was settling in the row before her, two boys in blue jackets and trousers, with laid-down shirt collars, a little girl in a shawl and a braided frock, then two more little girls ushered in by their governess, a thin-looking sort with a hooked nose and watery eyes sniffling into her handkerchief, then the oldest boy sauntering in, a sneer on his face, then Papa, with dress coat and cane and whiskers, and fat Mama, with long ringlets and a big nasty hat and three gold rings on her plump, soft fingers. Finally all were seated amid a shuffling of coats and shawls, and a munching of candied orange peel, quite patently well-behaved and expecting improvement. Clean and soaped and prosperous in their snug, machine-made clothes. A clerky fellow with spectacles took the next seat to Sybil's, an inch-wide blue strip showing at his hairline, where he'd shaved his forehead to suggest intellect. He was reading Mick's programme and sucking an acidulated lemon drop, and passed him a trio of officers on furlough from the Crimea, looking very pleased with themselves, come to hear about an old-fashioned war in Texas, fought the old-fashioned way. There were other soldiers speckled through the crowd, bright in their red coats, the respectable sort who didn't go for drabs and gin, but would take the Queen's pay and learn gunnery arithmetic and come back to work in the railroads and shipyards and better themselves. The place was full of bettering blokes, really. Shopkeepers and store clerks and druggists with their tidy wives and broods. In her father's day, such people, Whitechapel people, had been angry and lean and shabby, with sticks in their hands and dirks in their belts, but times had changed under the Rads, and now even Whitechapel had its tight-laced, scrub-faced women and its cakey, clock-watching men, who read the Dictionary of Useful Knowledge and the Journal of Moral Improvement, and looked to get ahead. Then the gas lights guttered in their copper rings, and the orchestra swung into a flat rendition of Come to the Bower. With a huff, the limelight flared. The curtain drew back before the kinetrope screen, the music covering the clicking of kinobits spinning themselves into place. Broken frills and furbelows grew like black frost on the edges of the screen. They framed tall letters in a fancy alphabet of sharp-edged engine Gothic, black against white. Edition Panoptique presents... And below the kinetrope, Houston entered stage left, a bulky, shabby figure limping toward the podium at the center of the stage. He was drowned in dimness for the moment, below the raw and focused glare of Mick's limelight. Sybil watched him closely, curious about him, wary. Her first glimpse of Mick's employer. She'd seen enough American refugees in London to have ideas about them. The Unionists dressed much like normal Britons, if they had the money for it, while Confederates tended to dress rather gaudy and flash, but peculiar, not quite proper. To judge by Houston, the Texians were an even queerer and madder lot. He was a big man, red-faced and beefy, over 6 feet tall in his heavy boots, his broad shoulders draped in a long coarse-woven blanket, rather like a mantlet, but barbarically striped. Red and black and umber, it swept the Garrick's stage like a tragedian's toga. He had a thick mahogany cane in his right hand, and he swung it lightly now as if he didn't need it. But his legs shook, Sybil saw, and the gold fringe trembled on the fancy seams of his trousers. Now he mounted to the darkened podium, wiped his nose, sipped at a glass of something that plainly wasn't water. Above his head the kinetrope shuffled into a coloured image, the lion of Great Britain and a sort of long-horned bull. The animals fraternised beneath small crossed banners, the Union Jack and the single-starred flag of Texas, both bright in red and white and blue. Houston was adjusting something behind his podium, a small stage mirror, Sybil guessed, so he could check the kinetrope behind him as he spoke and not lose his place. The kinetrope went to black and white again, the screen's bits flickering row by row like falling dominoes.
A portrait bust appeared in shaded, jagged lines, high balding forehead, heavy brows, thick nose bracketed by bristling cheek whiskers that hid the ears. The thin mouth was set firmly, the cleft chin upraised. Then, below the bust, the words, "General Sam Houston." A second limelight flared, catching Houston at the podium, flinging him into sudden bright relief before the audience. Sybil clapped hard. She was the last to finish.
"Thank you very kindly, ladies and gentlemen of London," Houston said.
He had the deep, booming voice of a practiced orator, marred by a foreign drawl.
"You do a stranger great honor."
Houston looked across the seats of the Garrick.
"I see we have many gentlemen of Her Majesty's military in the audience tonight."
He shrugged the blanket back a bit, and limelight glittered harshly from the medals clinging to his coat.
"Your professional interest is very gratifying, sirs."
In the row before Sybil, the children were fidgeting. A little girl squealed in pain as one of her brothers punched her.
"And I see we have a future British fighter here as well."
There was a ripple of surprised laughter. Houston checked his mirror quickly, then leaned over his podium, his heavy brows knitting in grandfatherly charm.
"What's your name, son?"
The wicked boy sat bolt upright.
"Billy, sir," he squeaked. "Billy, William Greenacre, sir."
Houston nodded gravely.
"Tell me, Master Greenacre, would you like to run away from home and live with Red Indians?"
"Oh, yes, sir," the boy blurted, and then, "Oh, no, sir."
The audience laughed again.
"When I was about your age, young William, I was a lad of spirit like yourself, and that was the very course of action I pursued."
The kino shuffled behind the general's head, and a coloured map appeared, outlines of the various states of America, oddly shaped provinces with confusing names. Houston checked his mirror and spoke rapidly.
"I was born in the American state of Tennessee. My family was of the Scottish gentry, though times were hard for us on our little frontier farm. And though I was born an American, I felt little allegiance to the Yankee government in far Washington."
The kinotrope displayed the portrait of an American savage, a mad-eyed, staring creature hung with feathers, cheeks streaked with kino blocks of war paint.
"Just across the river," Houston said, "lived the mighty nation of the Cherokee, a simple folk of natural nobility. I found this suited me far better than a life with my American neighbors. Alas, for their souls were pinched by the greed for dollars."
Houston shook his head a bit before his British audience, pained at his own allusion to an American national failing. He had their sympathy, Sybil thought.
"The Cherokees won my heart," Houston continued, "and I ran from home to join them with nothing, ladies and gentlemen, but the buckskin coat on my back and Homer's noble tale of the Iliad in my pocket."
The kinotrope shuffled itself bottom to top, producing an image from a Grecian urn, a warrior with a crested helmet, his spear upraised. He bore a round shield with the emblem of a raven, wings outspread. There was a light pattering of impressed applause, which Houston accepted, nodding modestly as if it were meant for him.
"As a child of the American frontier," he said, "I can't claim to have had much fine schooling, although in later life I passed the bar and led a nation. As a youth, however, I sought my education in an ancient school. I committed every line of the blind bard's book to memory."
He lifted the medal-strewn lapel of his coat, left-handed.
"The heart within this scarred breast," he said, and thumped it, "still stirs to that noblest of stories, with its tales of valor to challenge the very gods, and of unstained martial honor that endures till death."
He waited for applause. At length it came, though not as warmly as he seemed to expect.
"I saw no contradiction in the lives of Homer's heroes and those of my beloved Cherokees," Houston persisted.
Behind him, the Greek's javelin sprouted the dangling feathers of a hunting spear, and war paint daubed his face. Houston peered at his notes.
"Together we hunted bear and deer and boar, fished the limpid stream and raised the yellow corn. Around the campfire, under open skies, I told my savage brothers of the moral lessons that my youthful heart had gleaned from Homer's words. Because of this, they gave me the red man's name of Raven,
after the feathered spirit that they deem the wisest of birds."
The Greek dissolved, giving way to a grander raven, its wings spread stiffly across the screen, its chest covered by a striped shield. Sybil recognized it. It was the American eagle, symbol of the sundered Union. But the white-headed Yankee bird had become Houston's black crow. It was clever, she decided, perhaps more clever than it was worth, for two of the kinetrope bits in the screen's upper left corner had jammed on their spindles, showing dots of leftover blue, a tiny fault, but annoying all out of proportion, like a bit of dust in one's eye. Mick's fancy clacking was working the Garrick's kino very hard. Distracted, Sybil had lost the thread of Houston's speech.
"The brazen cry of the battle trumpet in the camp of the Tennessee Volunteers."
Another kino portrait appeared, a man who looked rather like Houston, but with a tall shock of hair in front and hollow cheeks, identified by caption as General Andrew Jackson. There was a hiss of breath here and there, led by the soldiers, perhaps, and the crowd stirred. Some Britons still remembered Hickory Jackson, without fondness. To hear Houston tell it, Jackson had also bravely fought against Indians, had even been President of America for a time, but all that meant little here. Houston praised Jackson as his patron and mentor.
"An honest soldier of the people, who valued a man's true inner worth above the tinsel of wealth or show."
But the applause for this sentiment was grudging at best. Now another scene appeared, some kind of rude frontier fort. Houston narrated a tale of siege from his early military career when he'd fought a campaign under Jackson against the Indians called Creek. But he seemed to have lost his natural audience, the soldiers, for the three Crimea veterans in Sybil's row were still muttering angrily about Hickory Jackson.
"The damned war was over before New Orleans."
Suddenly the limelight flashed blood red. Mick was busy beneath the stage, a tinted glass filter, the sudden booming of a kettle drum, as little kino cannons cracked gunpowder white around the fort, and single-bit flickers of red cannon shell arched rapidly across the screen.
"Night after night, we heard the Creek fanatics howling their eerie death songs," Houston shouted, a pillar of glare beneath the screen. "The situation demanded a direct assault with cold steel. It was said to be certain death to charge that gate. But I was not a Tennessee volunteer for nothing."
A tiny figure dashed toward the fort, no more than a few black squares, a wriggling block of bits, and the entire stage went black. There was surprised applause in the sudden darkness. The Penny boys up in the Garrick's gallery whistled shrilly. Then limelight framed Houston again. He began to boast about his wounds, two bullets in the arm, a knife stab in the leg, an arrow into his belly. Houston didn't say the vulgar word, but he did rub that area lingeringly, as if he were dyspeptic. He'd lain all night on the battlefield, he claimed, and then been hauled for 6 days through wilderness on a supply cart, bleeding, raving, sick with swamp fever. The Clarky Cove next to Sybil took another lemon drop and looked at his pocket watch. Now a five-pointed star appeared slowly amidst the funereal black of the screen as Houston narrated his lingering escape from the grave. One of the jammed kino bits had popped loose again, but another had jammed in the meantime on the lower right. Sybil stifled a yawn. The star brightened slowly as Houston spoke about his entry into American politics, presenting as his motive the desire to help his persecuted pet Cherokees. This was exotic enough, Sybil thought, but at its heart lay the same snicky, humbugging politicians always talked, and the audience was growing restive. They would have liked more fighting, or perhaps more poetic talk about life with the Cherokees. Instead, Houston had settled into a litany of his election to some rude equivalent of Parliament, various obscure posts in provincial government, and all the while the star grew slowly, its edges branching elaborately, becoming the emblem of the government of Tennessee. Sybil's eyelids grew heavy, fluttered, while the general blustered on. Quite suddenly, Houston's tone changed, becoming lingering, sentimental, a honeyed lilt creeping into his drawl. He was talking about a woman. Sybil sat up straighter, listening. Houston had been elected governor, it seemed, and had gotten himself some tin and been cheery about it, and he'd found himself a sweetheart, some Tennessee gentry girl, and married her. But on the kino's screen, fingers of darkness crept in snake-like from the edges. They menaced the state seal.
Governor and Mrs. Houston had scarcely settled in when Wifey kicked over the traces and fled back to her family. She'd left him a letter, Houston said, a letter that contained an awful secret, a secret he had never revealed and had sworn to carry to his grave.
A private matter, of which a gentleman of honor cannot and should not speak. Black disaster struck me.
The newspapers, apparently they did have newspapers in Tennessee, had attacked him.
The tattling mouths of libel poured their venom on me, Houston lamented,
as the Greek shield with the raven appeared, and black kino blobs, mud, Sybil supposed, began to spatter it. Houston's revelations grew shocking. He'd actually gone through with it, had divorced his wife of all the unlikely, awful things. Of course, he'd lost his position in government. Outraged society had hounded him from office, and Sybil wondered why Houston had dared to mention such an ugly scandal. It was as if he expected his London audience to morally approve of a divorced man. Still, she noticed, the ladies seemed intrigued and not entirely without sympathy, perhaps. Even the fat mamma fluttered at her double chins with a fan. General Houston was a foreigner, after all, half a savage by his own account, but when he spoke of his wife it was tenderly, as of a true love, a love slain by some cruel, mysterious truth. His bellowing voice broke with unashamed emotion. He mopped at his forehead a bit with a fancy handkerchief from his leopard-skin vest. In truth, he wasn't a bad-looking cove. Over 60, but that sort could be kinder to a girl. His confession seemed bold and manly, for he himself had brought the matter up, the divorce scandal and the secret letter from Mrs. Houston. He wouldn't stop talking about it, but neither would he tell them the secret. He'd pricked the curiosity of his audience, and Sybil herself was simply dying to know. She chided herself for being so cakey, for it was likely something stupid and simple, not half so deep and mysterious as he feigned. Likely his gentry girl wasn't half so angelic as she'd looked. Likely she'd had her maiden virtue stolen from her by some good-looking Tennessee beau-trap long before Raven Houston came along. Men had hard rules for their brides, if never for themselves. Likely Houston had brought it all on himself. Perhaps he had beastly vile ideas about married life, come from living with savages. Or perhaps he'd milled his wife about with his fists, for Sybil fancied he'd be a right bully rock in his cups. The kino came alive with harpies, meant to symbolize Houston's slanderers, those who'd smeared his precious honor with the ink of a gutter press. Nasty, crooky-back things, crowding the screen in devilish black and red. As the screen whirred steadily, they twitched their cloven hooves. Never had she seen the like, some Manchester punch-card artist having gotten the gin horrors sure. Now Houston was ranting about challenges and honour, by which he meant duelling, Americans being most famous duelists, who loved guns and shot each other at the drop of a hat. He'd have killed some of those newspaper rascals, Houston insisted loudly, if he hadn't been governor and on his dignity. So instead he'd thrown in his cards and gone back to live with his precious Cherokees. He had a real head of steam up now. He'd stoked himself so it was almost frightening to watch. The audience was entertained, their reserve broken by his bulging eyes and veiny Texian neck, but none too far from disgust. Maybe it had been something really dreadful that he'd done, Sybil thought, rubbing her hands together inside her rabbit-skin muff. Maybe it was ladies' fever, that he'd given his own wife a case of the glue. Some types of glue were horrible and could make you mad, or blind, or crippled. Maybe that was the secret. Mick might know. Very likely Mick knew all about it. Houston explained that he had left the United States in disgust and gone to Texas, and at the word a map appeared, a sprawl of land in the middle of the continent. Houston claimed he'd gone there seeking land for his poor, suffering Cherokee Indians, but it was all a bit confusing. Sybil asked the clerky fellow next to her for the time. Only an hour had passed. The speech was a third gone. Her moment was coming.
"You must envision a nation many times the size of your home islands," said Houston, "with no roads greater than the grassy tracks of Indians. Without at that time a single mile of British railroad and lacking the telegraph or indeed engine resources of any kind. As commander-in-chief of the Texian National Forces, my orders had no courier more swift or more reliable than the mounted scout, his way menaced by the Comanche and Carrancoa, by Mexican raiding parties, and by the thousand nameless hazards of the wilderness."
Small wonder, then, that Colonel Travis should receive my orders too late, and place his confidence, tragically, in the reinforcing party led by Colonel Fannin. Surrounded by an enemy force, 50 times his own, Colonel Travis declared his objective to be victory or death, knowing full well that the latter was a surely fated outcome. The defenders of the Alamo perished to a man. The noble Travis, the fearless Colonel Bowie, and David Crockett, a very legend among frontiersmen.
Messrs. Travis, Bowie, and Crockett each had a third of the keynote screen, their faces gone strangely square with the cramped scale of their depiction.
But precious time for my Fabian strategy.
More soldier talk. Now he stepped back from the podium and pointed up at the keynote with his heavy, polished cane.
The forces of Lopez de Santa Anna were arrayed as you see them here, with the woods upon his left flank and the San Jacinto River marshes at his back. His siege engineers had dug in around the baggage train with emplacements of sharpened timber, represented thusly. By a forced march through Burnham's Ford, however, my army of 600 had seized the wooded banks of Buffalo Bayou, unbeknown to enemy intelligence. The assault began with a brisk cannon fire from the Texian center. Now we can witness the movement of the Texian light cavalry. The shock of the foot charge sent the enemy reeling in confusion, throwing his artillery, which was not yet limbered, into utter disarray.
The Kinotrope's blue squares and lozenges slowly chased the buckling red Mexican regiments through the checkered greens and whites of woods and swamps. Sybil shifted in her seat, trying to ease the chafing of her hoop skirt. Houston's bloodthirsty boasting was finally reaching a climax.
The final count of the fallen numbered 2 Texian dead, 630 of the invader. The massacres of Alamo and Goliad were avenged in Sandinista blood. 2 Mexican armies, utterly defeated, with the capture of 14 officers and 20 cannon.
14 officers, 20 cannon. Yes, that was her cue. Her moment had come.
"Avengers, General Houston!"
Sybil shrieked, her throat constricted with stage fright. She tried again, pulling herself to her feet, waving one arm.
"Avenge us, General Houston!"
Houston halted, taken aback. Sybil shouted at him shrilly,
"Avenge our honour, sir! Avenge Britain's honour!"
A babble of alarm rose. Sybil felt the eyes of the theatre crowd in upon her, shocked looks that people might give a lunatic.
"My brother!"
she shouted, but fear had seized her, bad nerves. She hadn't expected it to be so frightening. This was worse than singing on stage, far worse. Houston lifted both his arms, the striped blanket spreading behind him like a cloak. Somehow he calmed the crowd by the gesture, asserted command. Above his head the kinotrope wound slowly down, its flickering domino tricks whirring to a stop, leaving San Jacinto frozen in mid-victory. Houston fixed Sybil with a look of mingled sternness and resignation.
"What is it, my dear young lady? What troubles you? Tell me."
Sybil gripped the back of the seat before her, closed her eyes tight, and sang it out.
"Sir, my brother is in a Texian prison. We are British, but the Texians imprisoned him, sir. They seized his farm and his cattle. They even stole the very railroad that he worked on. A British railroad, built for Texas."
Her voice was faltering despite herself. Mick wouldn't like that. He would scold her performance. The thought put a jolt of vitality into her. She opened her eyes.
"That regime, sir, the thieving Texian regime, they stole that British railroad. They robbed the workers in Texas and the stockholders here in Britain, and paid us not a penny."
With the loss of the kinotrope's bright play of images, the theatre's atmosphere had changed. Everything was quite different suddenly, oddly intimate and strange. It was as if she and the general were somehow framed together, 2 figures on a silvered daguerreotype. A young London woman in her bonnet and elegant shawl reaches up with eloquent distress to the old foreign hero. Both part players now, with the surprised eyes of the public silently fixed on them.
"You suffer because of the hunter?"
Houston said.
"Yes, sir,"
Sybil cried, a practiced quaver stealing into her voice. "Don't frighten them," Mick had said, "but make them pity you."
"Yes, the junta did it. They have flung my brother into their vile prison for no crime, sir, but simply because my dead brother is a Houston man. He voted for you when you became president of Texas, sir, and he would vote for you today, although I fear very much they will kill him."
"What is your brother's name, my dear lady?"
Houston asked.
Jones, sir," Sybil quickly cried. "Edwin Jones, of Nacogdoches, who worked for Hedgecock's railway company."
"I believe I know young Edward,"
Houston declared, his surprise evident in his tone. He clutched his cane angrily and his heavy brows knotted.
"Listen to her, Sam,"
came a sudden deep voice. Sybil, alarmed, turned to look. It was the man from the Argyle rooms, the fat actor, with his red hair and brushed velvet waistcoat.
"Those junta rascals appropriated the Hedgecock's railway. A pretty business that from a supposed British ally. Is this the gratitude they show for years of British guidance and protection?"
He sat back down.
"They're nothing but thieves and villains,"
Sybil shouted alertly. She groped quickly in memory, picking up the thread.
"General Houston, I'm a defenceless woman, but you're a man of destiny, a man of greatness. Can't there be justice for Texas, sir? Some redress for these affronts? Must my poor brother die there in misery while cheats and tyrants steal our British property?"
But Mick's fine rhetoric was drowned. There were shouts from the audience here and there over a muttered undertone of surprise and approval. Loud, boyish hooting came from the penny gallery. A bit of London fun, all told. Perhaps, Sybil thought, she had made some of them believe her story and pity her. Most simply howled and joked a bit, pleased to see some unexpected liveliness.
"Sam Houston was always a true friend of Britain,"
Sybil shrieked into the crowd's upturned faces. The words half lost, useless. She raised the back of her wrist to her damp forehead. Mick had given her no more lines, so she let the strength seep from her legs and fell back, eyes fluttering, half sinking into her seat.
"Give Miss Jones air," Houston commanded,
an excited bellow.
"The lady is overcome!"
Sybil watched through half-closed lids as blurred figures haltingly gathered round her, dark evening jackets, a rustle of crinoline, gardenia perfume, and a masculine smell of tobacco. A man seized her wrist and felt for a pulse there with pinching fingers. A woman fanned Sybil's face, clucking to herself. Oh, heaven, Sybil thought, shrinking. The fat mamma from the row before her, with that intolerable, oily look of a good woman doing her moral duty. A little thrill of shame and disgust shot through her. For a moment she felt genuinely weak, sinking with a buttery ease into the warmth of their concern, a half-dozen busybodies muttering around her in a shared pretense of competence, while Houston thundered on above them, hoarse with indignation. Sybil allowed them to get her to her feet. Houston hesitated, seeing it, and there was a light, gallant scatter of applause for her. She felt pale, unworthy. She smiled wanly and shook her head and wished she were invisible. She leaned her head on the padded shoulder of the man who had taken her pulse.
"Sir, if I could go, please," she whispered.
Her rescuer nodded alertly, a little fellow with clever blue eyes. His long graying hair was parted in the middle.
"I shall see the lady home," he piped at the others.
He shrugged into an opera cape, perched a tall beaver hat on his head, and lent her his arm. They walked together up the aisle, Sybil leaning on him heavily, unwilling to meet anyone's eyes. The crowd was roused now. For the first time, perhaps, they were listening to Houston as a man, rather than as some sort of queer American exhibit. Her little gentleman held dingy velvet aside for her as they emerged into the Garrick's chilly foyer, with its flaking gilt cupids and damp-marked faux marble walls.
"'Tis very kind of you, sir, to help me so,"
Sybil offered, noting that her escort looked as though he might have money.
"Are you a medical man?"
"I was a student once," he said with a shrug. His cheeks were flushed, twin hot points of red.
"It gives a man a certain air of distinction,"
Sybil said, not for any particular purpose, but just to fill the silence.
"Schooling of that sort, I mean?"
"Hardly, madame. I wasted all my time versifying. I must say that you seem fit enough now. Very sorry to hear about that unfortunate brother of yours."
"Thank you, sir."
Sybil looked at him sidelong.
"I'm afraid it was very forward of me. But General Houston's eloquence carried me away."
He shot her an opaque glance, the look of a man who suspects that a woman is gulling him.
"In all honesty," he said, "I do not entirely share your enthusiasm."
He coughed explosively into a wadded handkerchief and wiped his mouth.
"This London air will be the death of me."
"Nonetheless, I do thank you, sir, though I regret we've not been introduced."
"Keats," he said. "Mr. Keats."
He drew a ticking silver chronometer from his waistcoat, a many-dialed thing the size of a small potato, and consulted it.
"I'm not familiar with the district," he said distantly. "I'd thought to hail you a cabriolet, but at this hour—"
"Oh, no, Mr. Keats, thank you, but I shall go by the Underground."
His bright eyes widened. No respectable woman rode the Underground unescorted.
"But you haven't told me your profession, Mr. Keats," she said, hoping to distract him.
"Kinotropy," Keats said. "The techniques employed here tonight are of some special interest. While the screen's resolution is quite modest and the refresh rate positively slow, remarkable effects have been secured, one presumes through algorithmic compression. But I fear that is all a bit technical." He put away his chronometer. "Are you entirely certain you wouldn't rather I attempted to hail a cab? Do you know London well, Miss Jones?"
"I might escort you to the local omnibus stand. 'Tis a railless carriage, you see." "No, sir. Thank you. You've been exceptionally kind."
"You're quite welcome," he said, his relief evident as he opened and held one of the half-glass doors to the street.
Just then a skinny boy sidled rapidly up behind them, brushed past and out of the theatre without a word. He was draped in a long, dirty coat of canvas, something a fisherman might wear. A singular thing to wear to a lecture, Sybil thought, though one saw queerer garments on the poor. The sleeves flapped emptily as though the boy were hugging himself, against a chill perhaps. His gait was odd, bent backed as if he were drunk or ill.
"I say there, young man."
Mr. Keats had produced a coin, and Sybil understood that he wished the boy to hail a cab for her, but now the wet eyes gleamed at them with alarm, the pale face hollowed by gaslight. Suddenly he bolted, something dark tumbling from beneath his coat, where it rolled into the gutter. The boy halted and looked warily back at them. He dropped a hat, a top hat. He came trotting back, eyes still on them, snatched it up, stuffed it under his coat and off again, into the shadows, though this time not nearly so rapidly.
"'Pon my word!" Mr. Keats said in disgust. "That fellow's a thief. That waterproof is stuffed with the hats of the audience."
Sybil could think of nothing to say.
"I imagine the rascal took cruel advantage of that commotion you caused,"
Keats told her, his tone lightly etched with suspicion.
"Pity. One never knows who to trust these days."
"Sir, I do believe I hear the engine getting up steam for the kinotrope."
And that was enough for him. The installation of exhaust fans, said the Daily Telegraph, had wrought a perceptible improvement in the atmosphere of the Metropolitan, though Lord Babbage himself held that a truly modern underground railway would operate on pneumatic principles exclusively, involving no combustion whatever, rather in the way mail was conveyed throughout Paris. Seated in a second-class carriage, breathing as shallowly as possible, Sybil knew it all for humbug, or in any case the improvement part, for who knew what marvels the Rads mightn't bring forth. But hadn't the Rad papers also published the testimony of medicals in the pay of the railroad that sulphurous fumes were therapeutic for asthma? And it wasn't only the fumes from the engines, but vile sewer seepings as well, and gassy leakings from collapsible India rubber bags that lit the carriage jets in their wire-netted glass shades. It was a queer business, the Underground, when you thought about it. Racketing along at such speeds, through the darkness under London, where the navvies had come upon lead water pipes of the Romans, and coins, mosaics, and archways, elephants' teeth 1,000 years old. And the digging went on, this and every night, for she'd heard their great machine huffing as she'd stood by Mick on the Whitechapel pavement. They worked unceasingly, the excavators, boring newer, deeper lines now, down below the tangle of sewers and gas pipes and bricked-over rivers. The new lines were shored with steel, and soon Lord Babbage's smokeless trains would slide through them, silent as eels, though she found the thought of it somehow unclean. The lamps flared all at once, the flow of gas disturbed by a peculiarly sharp jolt, the faces of the other passengers seeming to leap out at her. The sallow gent with something of the successful publican about him, the round-cheeked old Quaker cleric, the drunken dandy with his coat open, his canary waistcoat all dotted down the front with claret. There were no other women in the carriage.
"Farewell to you, sirs," she imagined herself crying. "Farewell to your London."
For she was a prentice adventuress now, sworn and true, bound for Paris, though the first leg of the voyage consisted necessarily of the twopenny trip back to Whitechapel. But the clergyman had noticed her, his contempt quite open, there for anyone to see.
It was really quite horribly cold, making her way from the station to her room in Flower and Dean Street. She regretted her vanity, for having chosen her fine new shawl rather than her mantlet. Her teeth were chattering. Sharp frost shone in pools of gaslight on the street's new macadam. The cobbles of London were vanishing month by month, paved over with black stuff that poured stinking hot from the moors of great wagons, for navvies to spread and smooth with rakes before the advance of the steamroller. A daring fellow whisked past her, taking full advantage of the gritty new surface. Nearly recumbent within the creaking frame of a four-wheeled velocipede, his shoes were strapped to whirling cranks, and his breath puffed explosively into the cold. He was bareheaded and goggled in a thick, striped jersey, a long-knit scarf flapping out behind him as he sped away. Sybil supposed him an inventor. London was rife with inventors, the poorer and madder of them congregating in the public squares to display their blueprints and models, and harangue the strolling crowds. In a week's time she'd encountered a wicked-looking device meant to crimp hair by electricity, a child's mechanical top that played Beethoven, and a scheme for electroplating the dead. Leaving the thoroughfare for the unimproved cobbles of Renton Passage, she made out the sign of the heart and heard the jangle of a pianola. It was Mrs. Winterhalter who'd arranged for her to room above the heart. The public house itself was a steady sort of place, admitting no women. It catered to junior clerks and shopmen, and offered as its raciest pleasure a pull at a coin-fed wagering machine. The rooms above were reached by way of steep, dark stairs that climbed below a sooty skylight to an alcove presenting a pair of identical doors. Mr. Cairns, the landlord, had rooms behind the door on the left. Sybil climbed the stairs, fumbled a penny box of lucifers from her muff, and struck one. Cairns had chained a bicycle to the iron railing overlooking the stairwell. The bright brass padlock gleamed in the flare of the match. She shook the lucifer out, hoping that Hetty hadn't double-latched the door. Hetty hadn't, and Sybil's key turned smoothly in the lock. Toby was there to greet her, padding silently across the bare boards to twine himself around and about her ankles, purring like 60. Hetty had left an oil lamp turned down low on the deal table that stood in the hallway. It was smoking now, the wick in need of trimming. A foolish thing to have left it burning, where Toby might have sent it crashing. But Sybil felt grateful not to have found the place in darkness. She took Toby up in her arms. He smelled of herring.
"Has Hetty fed you, then, dear?"
he yowled softly and batted at the ribbons of her bonnet. The pattern of the wallpaper danced as she lifted the lamp. The hallway had seen no sunlight in all the years the heart had stood, yet the printed flowers were gone a shade like dust. Sybil's room had two windows, though they opened on a blank wall of grimed yellow brick, so near she could have touched it if someone hadn't driven nails into the casements. Still, on a bright day, with the sun directly overhead, a bit of light did filter in. And Hetty's room, though larger, had only one window. If Hetty was here, now, she must be alone and asleep, as no light was visible from the crack at the bottom of her closed door. It was good to have one's own room, one's privacy, however modest. Sybil put Toby down, though he protested, and carried the lamp to her own door, which stood slightly ajar. Inside, all was as she'd left it, though she saw that Hetty had left the latest number of the Illustrated London News on her pillow, with an engraving from Crimea on the front, a scene of a city all aflame. She set the lamp down on the cracked marble lid of the commode, Toby prowling about her ankles as though he expected to discover more herring, and considered what she should do. The ticking of the fat tin alarm clock, which she sometimes found unbearable, was reassuring now. At least it was running, and she imagined that the time it showed, 11:15, was correct. She gave the winder a few turns just for luck. Mick would come for her at midnight, and there were decisions to be made, as he'd advised her to travel very light. She took a wick trimmer from the commode's drawer, raised the lamp's chimney, and scissored away the blackened bit. The light improved somewhat. She threw on her mantlet against the cold, opened the lid of a japanned tin chest, and began to make an inventory of her better things. But after setting aside two changes of undergarments, it came to her that the less she took, the more Dandy Mick would have to buy for her in Paris. And if that wasn't thinking like a prentice adventuress, she didn't know what was. Still, she did have some things she was specially fond of.
and these went along with the undergarments into her brocaded portmanteau with a split seam she'd meant to mend. There was a lovely bottle of rose-scented Portland water, half full, a green-paste brooch from Mr. Kingsley, a set of hairbrushes with imitation ebony backs, a miniature flower press with a souvenir view of Kensington Palace, and a patent German curling iron she'd nicked from a hairdresser's. She added a bone-handled toothbrush and a tin of camphorated dentifrice. Now she took a tiny, silver-propelling pencil and settled herself on the edge of her bed to write a note to Hetty. The pencil was a gift from Mr. Chadwick, with the Metropolitan Railway Corporation engraved along its shaft. The plate was starting to flake away from the brass beneath. For paper, she found she had only the back of a handbill advertising instantaneous chocolate. "My dear Harriet," she began, "I am off to Paris." But then she paused, removed the pencil's cap, and used the rubber to erase those last three words, substituting, "Run away with a gentleman. Do not be alarmed. I am well. You are welcome to any clothes I leave behind, and please do take care of dear Toby and give him herring. Yours sincerely, Sybil." It made her feel queer to write it, and when she looked down at Toby she felt sad and forced to leave him. With this thought came thoughts of Radley. She was struck by a sudden and utter conviction of his falsehood. "He will come," she whispered fiercely. She put the lamp and the folded note on the narrow mantel. On the mantel lay a flat tin, brightly lithographed, with the name of a Strand tobacconist. She knew that it contained Turkish cigarettes. One of Hetty's younger gentlemen, a medical student, had once urged her to take up the habit. Sybil generally avoided medical students. They prided themselves on studied beastliness. But now, in the grip of a powerful, nervous impulse, she opened the tin, drew out one of the crisp paper cylinders, and inhaled its fierce perfume. A Mr. Stanley, a barrister, well known among the flash mob, had smoked cigarettes incessantly. Stanley, during his acquaintanceship with Sybil, had frequently remarked that a cigarette was the thing to steal a gambler's nerve. Fetching the lucifers, Sybil placed the cigarette between her lips, as she'd seen Stanley do, struck a lucifer, and remembered to let the bulk of the sulphur burn away before applying the flame to the cigarette's tip. She drew hesitantly on the lit cigarette, and was rewarded with an acrid portion of vile smoke that set her racking like a consumptive. Eyes watering, she nearly flung the thing away. She stood before the grate and forced herself to continue, drawing periodically on the cigarette and flicking pale, delicate ash onto the coals, with the gesture Stanley had used. It was barely tolerable, she decided, and where was the desired effect? She felt abruptly ill, her stomach churning with nausea, her hands gone cold as ice. Coughing explosively, she dropped the cigarette into the coals, where it burst into flame and was swiftly consumed. She became painfully aware of the ticking of the clock. Big Ben began to sound midnight. Where was Mick? She woke in darkness, filled with a fear she couldn't name. Then she remembered Mick. The lamp had gone out. The coals were dead. Scrambling to her feet, she fetched the box of lucifers, then felt her way into her room, where the tinny ticking of the clock guided her to the commode. When she struck a match, the face of the clock seemed to swim in the sulphur glare. It was 1:30. Had he come when she was sleeping, knocked, had no answer and gone away without her? No, not Mick. He'd have found a way in if he wanted her. Had he gulled her, then, for the cakey girl she surely was, to trust his promises? A queer sort of calm swept over her, a cruel clarity. She remembered the departure date on the steamship ticket. He wouldn't sail from Dover till late tomorrow, and it seemed unlikely that he and General Houston would be departing London after an important lecture in the dead of night. She'd go to Grand's, then, and find Mick, confront him, and plead, threaten blackmail, exposure, whatever proved necessary. What tin she had was in her muff. There was a cab stand in Minnerers by Goodman's Yard. She would go there now and rouse a cabman to take her to Piccadilly. Toby cried once, piteously, as she closed the door behind her. She scraped her shin cruelly in the dark, on Cairns's chained bicycle. She was half the way down Minnerers to Goodman's Yard when she remembered her portmanteau, but there was no turning back. Grand's knight doorman was heavy-set, cold-eyed, chin-whiskered, stiff in one leg, and very certainly wouldn't allow Sybil into his hotel, not if he could help it. She'd twigged him from a block away, climbing down from her cabriolet, a big, gold-braided bugaboo lurking on the hotel's marble steps under great dolphin-wreathed lamps. She knew her doormen well enough. They played a major role in her life. It was one thing to enter Grand's on Dandy Mick's arm by daylight, but to walk in boldly from the midnight streets as an unescorted woman was another matter. Only whores did that, and the doorman would not let whores in. But she might think of a likely story to gull him, perhaps, if she thought of a very good lie, and if he were stupid, or careless, or weary. Or she might try to bribe him, though she had little enough of tin left after the cab. And she was dressed proper, not in the flash clothes of a dolly mop. She might, at a pinch, distract him, smash a window with a cobblestone and run past him when he came to look. It was hard to run in a crinoline, but he was lame and slow. Or find a street boy to throw a stone for her. Sybil stood in darkness by the wooden hoardings of a construction site. Broadside posters loomed over her, bigger than bedsheets, with great tattered shouting print. Daily News, worldwide circulation. Lloyd's News, only one penny. Southeastern Railway, Ramsgate and Margate, 7 and 6. Sybil pulled one hand from her muff and gnawed feverishly at her fingernail, which smelled of Turkish tobacco. She was dully surprised to notice that her hand was blue-white with the cold and trembling badly. Pure luck, it seemed, rescued her then, or the nod of a sorrowing angel, for a shining gurney broom came to a chugging halt in front of Grand's, its blue-coated fireman jumping down to lower the hinged step. Out came a rollicking mob of drunken Frenchmen in scarlet-lined capes, with brocade waistcoats and tasselled evening canes, and two of them had women with them. Sybil grabbed up her skirt on the instant and scurried forward head down. Crossing the street, she was hidden from the doorman by the barricade of the gurney's gleaming coachwork. Then she simply walked around it, past the great wood-spoked wheels with their treads of rubber, and boldly joined the group. The Frenchies were parlez-vousing at each other, moustache-stroking and giggling, and did not seem to notice her, nor care. She smiled piously at no one in particular, and stood very close to a tall one who seemed drunkest. They staggered up the marble stairs, and the tall Frenchman slapped a pound note at the doorman's hand, with the careless ease of a man who didn't know what real money was. The doorman blinked at it, and touched his braided hat. And Sybil was safely inside. She walked with the jabbering Frenchies across a wilderness of polished marble to the hotel desk, where they collected their keys from the night clerk and staggered up the curving stairway yawning and grinning, leaving Sybil behind at the counter. The night clerk, who spoke French, was chuckling over something he'd overheard. He sidled down the length of lintled mahogany with a smile for Sybil. "How may I be of service, madame?" The words came hard, almost stammering at first.
"Could you tell me, please, has a Mr. Michael, or rather, is General Sam Houston still registered here?"
"Yes, madame. I did see General Houston earlier this evening. However, he's in our smoking room now. Perhaps you could leave a message."
"Smoking room?"
"Yes, over there, behind the acanthus." The clerk nodded toward a massive door at the corner of the lobby. "Our smoking room is not for the ladies, of course. Forgive me, madame, but you seem a bit distressed. If the matter's vital, perhaps I should send a page."
"Yes," Sybil said, "that would be wonderful."
The night clerk obligingly produced a sheet of cream-laid hotel stationery and proffered his gold-nibbed reservoir pen. She wrote hastily, folded the note, scrawled "Mr. Michael Radley" on the back. The night clerk crisply rang a bell, bowed in response to her thanks, and went about his business. Shortly, a yawning and sour-faced little page appeared and placed her note on a cork-topped salver. Sybil trailed anxiously behind as he trudged to the smoking room.
"It is for the General's personal secretary," she said.
"'Tis all right, miss, I know him."
He heaved one-handed at the smoking room door. As it opened and the page passed through, Sybil peered in. As the door slowly closed, she had a long glimpse of Houston, bareheaded, shiny-faced and sweaty-drunk, with one booted foot propped on the table beside a cut-glass decanter. He had a wicked-looking jackknife in his hand and was puffing smoke and jabbing at something. Whittling, that was it, for the floor around his leather chair was littered with wood shavings. A tall, bearded Englishman murmured something to Houston. The stranger had his left arm caught in a white silk sling and looked sad-eyed and dignified and important. Mick stood at his side, bending at the waist to light the man's cheroot. Sybil saw him rasping at a steel sparker on the end of a dangling rubber gas tube, and then the door shut. Sybil sat on a chaise longue in the echoing marble lobby, warmth stealing through her damp, grimy shoes. Her toes began to ache. Then the page emerged with Mick on his heels, Mick smiling back into the smoking room and sketching out a cheery half-salute. Sybil rose from her seat. Seeing her there, his narrow face went bleak. He came to her quickly, took her elbow.
"Bloody Christ," he muttered. "What kind of silly note was that? Can't you make sense, girl?"
"What is it?" she pleaded.
"Why didn't you come for me?"
"Bit of a contretemps, I'm afraid. Case of the fox biting his own ass. Might be funny if it weren't so bleeding difficult, but having you here now may change matters."
"What's gone wrong? Who's that gentry cove with the gammy arm?"
"Bloody British diplomat as doesn't care for the general's plan to raise an army in Mexico. Never you mind him. Tomorrow we'll be in France and he'll be here in London, annoying someone else. At least I hope so. The general's queered things for us, though. Drunk as a lord, and he's pulled one of his funny little tricks. He's a nasty bastard when he drinks, truth to tell. Starts to forget his friends."
"He's gulled you somehow," Sybil realized. "He wants to cut you loose, is that it?"
"He's nicked my Keno cards," Mick said.
"But I mailed them to Paris. Poste restante," Sybil said, "just as you told me to do."
"Not those, you goose. The Keno cards from the speech."
"Your theatre cards?"
"He stole them. He knew I had to pack my cards, take him along with me, don't you see? So he kept a watch on me somehow, and now he's nicked them from my baggage. Says he won't need me in France after all, so long as he's got my information. He'll hire some onion-eater can run a Keno on the cheap, or so he says."
"But that's theft."
"Borrowing, according to him. Says he'll give me back my cards as soon as he's had 'em copied. That way I don't lose nothing, you see?" Sybil felt dazed. Was he teasing her?
"But isn't that stealing somehow?"
"Try arguing that with Samuel Bloody Houston. He stole a whole damn country once, stole it clean and picked it to the bone."
"But you're his man. You can't let him steal from you."
Mick cut her off. "When it comes to that, you might well ask how I had that fancy French program made. You might say I borrowed the general's money for it, so to speak." He showed his teeth in a grin. "Not the first time we've tried such a stunt on one another. It's a bit of a test, don't you see? Fellow has to be a right out-and-outer to travel with General Houston."
"Oh, Lord," Sybil said, collapsing into her crinoline on the chaise. "Mick, if you but knew what I've been thinking."
"Brace up, then." He hauled her to her feet. "I need those cards, and they're in his room. You're going to find them for me and nick 'em back, and I'm going back in there and brass it out, cool as ice." He laughed. "The old bastard mightn't have tried this if not for my tricks at his lecture. You and Corny Sims made him think he was right and fly, pulling strings. But we'll make a pigeon of him yet, you and I together."
"I'm afraid, Mick," Sybil said. "I don't know how to steal things."
"You little goose. Of course you do," Mick said.
"Well, will you come with me and help, then?"
"Of course not. He'd know then, wouldn't he? I told him you were a newspaper friend of mine. If I stay too long talking, he'll smell a rat, sure."
He glared at her. "All right," Sybil said, defeated. "Give me the key to his room."
Mick grunted. "Key? I haven't any bloody key." A wash of relief went through her.
"Well, then, I'm not a cracksman, you know."
"Keep your voice down, else you'll tell everyone in Grands." His eyes glinted furiously. He was drunk, Sybil realized. She'd never seen Mick really drunk before, and now he was lushed, lightning struck. It didn't show in his voice or his walk, but he was crazy and bold with it. "I'll get you a key. Go to that counter man, blarney him, keep him busy, and don't look at me." He gave her half a shove.
"Go!"
Terrified, she returned to the counter. The Grand's telegraph stood at the far end, a ticking brass machine on a low marble pedestal decorated with leafy gilt vines. Within a sort of bell glass, a gilded needle swung to and fro, pointing out letters in a concentric alphabet. With every twitch of the needle, something in the marble base clunked methodically, causing another quarter inch of neatly perforated yellow paper tape to emerge from the marble base. The night clerk, who was punching binder holes in a bundle of fan-fold paper, set his work aside, clipped on a pince-nez, and came toward her.
"Yes, madame?"
"I need to send a telegram. It is rather urgent."
The clerk deftly assembled a small box of punch cards, a hinged brass perforator, a neatly ruled form. He took out the reservoir pen Sybil had used earlier. "Yes, madame. Citizen number?"
"Oh, would that be my number or his?"
"That would depend, madame. Are you planning to pay by national credit?"
"May I charge it to my room?"
Sybil hedged.
"Certainly, madame. Room number?"
Sybil hesitated for as long as she dared.
"I suppose I'll pay cash, actually."
"Very well. Now the addressee's citizen number."
"I'm afraid I don't know it, actually."
She blinked at the clerk and began to chew on one knuckle. He was very patient. "You do have a name and address, though."
"Oh, yes,"
Sybil said hastily.
"Mr. Charles Egremont, MP. The Beeches, Belgravia, London."
The clerk wrote this down.
"It is rather more costly to send a wire with only an address, madame. It's more efficient to route it direct through the Central Statistics Bureau."
Sybil had not been looking for Mick. She had been afraid to look. Now, from the corner of her eye, she saw a dark form scuttle across the lobby floor. Mick was bent almost double, with his shoes off, the laces knotted around his neck. He charged headlong at the waist-high mahogany counter, grabbed the forward edge two-handed, vaulted over it in a split second, and vanished. He'd made no sound at all.
"Something to do with the way an engine handles messages," the clerk was explaining.
"Indeed," Sybil said.
"But I haven't his citizen number. I shall have to pay the extra then, shan't I? This is very important."
"Yes, madame. I'm sure it is. Pray go on, and I shall take dictation."
"I don't suppose I should begin with my address and the date. I mean, a telegram's not a letter, really, is it?"
"No, madame."
"Or his address, either?"
"Brevity is the essence of telegraphy, madame." Mick would be creeping to the hotel's mahogany pegboard, which hung clustered with room keys. She couldn't see him, but now she imagined she could hear him moving, almost smell him, and the clerk needed only to glance to his right to discover a sneak thief creeping toward him, crazy-eyed and crouching like an ape.
"Please take this down," Sybil quavered. "Dear Charles,"
the clerk began scribbling,
"9 years ago you put me to the worst dishonour that a woman can know."
The clerk stared in horror at his pen, a hot flush creeping up past his collar.
"Charles, you promised me that you would save my poor father. Instead, you corrupted me, body and soul. Today I am leaving London in the company of powerful friends. They know very well what a traitor you were to Walter Gerard and to me. Do not attempt to find me, Charles. It would be useless. I do hope that you and Mrs. Egremont will sleep soundly tonight."
Sybil shuddered.
"Sign that Sybil Gerard, if you please."
"Yes, madame," the clerk muttered, eyes downcast as Mick sprang silently back over the counter in his stocking feet. Mick crouched low, hidden by the counter's bulk, then crept off quickly on his haunches, waddling across the marble floor like a monstrous duck. In a moment he had rolled behind a pair of overstuffed chairs.
"What do I owe?"
Sybil asked the clerk politely.
2 and 6,
the clerk stammered, quite unable to meet her eyes. She counted it out from the little clasp purse she took from her muff and left the red-faced clerk at his station, punching telegram cards from his box. Mick came strolling like a gentleman across the lobby. He paused beside a reading rack hung with neatly ironed newspapers. He bent down, coolly retying his shoes, straightened, and she saw the glint of metal in his hand. Not bothering even to catch her eye, he tucked the key behind a cut velvet cushion on the chaise longue. Then he stood briskly, straightened his tie, brushed at his sleeves, and strode straight off into the smoking room. Sybil sat for a moment on the chaise, pretending to read a gold-spined monthly. Transactions of the Royal Society. Carefully, with the fingertips of her right hand, she fished behind her for the key. Here it was, with the number 24 engraved on the oval brass. She yawned in what she hoped was a ladylike fashion and stood to retire upstairs, entirely as if she had a room there. Her feet ached. As she trudged along the silent gas-lit hall toward Houston's suite, she felt a sudden amazement at having struck out at Charles Egremont. Needing some dramatic message to distract the clerk, she'd blurted out threats and rage. It had come boiling out of her almost without her will. It puzzled her, and even frightened her, after having imagined that she'd almost forgotten the man. She could imagine the fear on Egremont's face when he read her telegram. She remembered his face well enough, fatuous and successful, which always looked as though it meant well, always apologized, always preached at her, and whined, and begged, and wept, and sinned. He was a fool. But now she'd let Mick Radley set her to thieving. If she were clever, she should walk out of the Grand Hotel, vanish into the depths of London, and never see Radley again. She should not let the Prentice oath hold her. To break an oath was frightening, but no more vile than her other sins. Yet somehow here she was. She had let him do with her as he would. She stopped before the door, looked up and down the deserted corridor, fingered the stolen key. Why was she doing this? Because Mick was strong and she was weak? Because he knew secrets that she didn't? For the first time it occurred to her that she might be in love with him. Perhaps she did love him in some strange way, and if that were true, it might explain matters to her in a way which was almost soothing. If she were in love, she had a right to burn her bridges, to walk on air, to live by impulse. And if she loved Radley, it was finally something she knew which he didn't. Her secret alone. Sybil unlocked the door nervously, rapidly. She slipped through, shut it behind her, set her back against it. She stood in darkness. There was a lamp in the room somewhere. She could smell its burnt wick. In the wall opposite, the outline emerged of a square, curtained window to the street, between the curtains a faint knife slice of upwashed gaslight. She faltered her way into the room, hands outstretched, until she felt the solid, polished bulk of a bureau, and made out the dim sheen of a lamp chimney there. She lifted the lamp, shook it. It had oil. Now she needed a lucifer. She felt for drawers in the bureau. For some reason they were already open. She rustled through them, stationary. Useless. And someone had spilled ink in one of the drawers. She could smell it. Her fingers brushed a box of lucifers, which she recognized less by touch than by the dry, familiar rattle. Her fingers really didn't seem to be working properly. The first lucifer popped and fizzled out, refusing to light, filling the room with a vile smell of sulphur. The second showed her the lamp. Her hands were trembling badly as she raised the chimney and applied flame to the wick. She saw her own lamp-lit reflection staring wild-eyed from the tilted cheval glass, then doubled in beveled mirrors set into the twin doors of a wardrobe. She noticed clothing scattered on the bed, on the floor. A man was sitting on the arm of a chair, crouched there like a great shadowed crow, an enormous knife in his hand. He stood then, but slowly, with a creak of leather. Like some huge wooden puppet that had lain years in the dust, he was wrapped in a long and shapeless grey coat. His nose and jaw were draped with a dark kerchief.
"Best be quiet now, missy," he said, holding up the massive blade, dark, cleaver-like steel. "Sam comin'?"
Sybil found her voice.
"Please don't kill me."
"Old goat still whoring, is he?"
The slow Texian voice slid forth like treacle. Sybil could barely make out the words.
"You as fancy gal?"
"No," Sybil said, her voice strangled. "No, I'm not. I swear it. I came here to steal from him, and that's the truth."
There was a ghastly silence.
"Take a look round you."
Sybil did so, trembling. The room had been ransacked.
"Nothing here to steal," the man said. "Where is he, gal?"
"He's downstairs," Sybil said. "He's drunk, but I don't know him, I swear. My man sent me here, that's all. I didn't want to do this. He made me do it."
"Quiet now," he said. "I wouldn't hurt a white woman unless I had to. Put out that lamp."
"Let me go," she pleaded. "I'll go straight away. I meant no harm."
"Harm?"
The slow voice was heavy with gallows certainty.
"What harm there is. It's for Houston, and that's justice."
"I didn't steal the cards. I didn't touch them."
"Cards?"
He laughed, a dry sound at the back of his throat.
"The cards don't belong to Houston. He stole them."
"Houston stole plenty," the man said,
but clearly he was puzzled. He was thinking about her and was not happy about it.
"What they call you?"
"Sybil Jones."
She took a breath.
"I'm a British subject."
"My,"
the man said. He clicked his tongue. His masked face was unreadable. Sweat shone on a strip of pale, smooth skin across the top of his forehead. A hat brim had rested there, Sybil realized, to shield him from the Texian sun.
He came forward now and took the lamp from her, turning down the wick. His fingers, when they brushed her hand, were dry and hard as wood. In the darkness there was only the pounding of her heart and the Texian's terrible presence.
"You must be lonely here in London,"
Sybil blurted, desperate to avoid another silence.
"Maybe Houston's lonesome. I got a better conscience."
The Texian's voice was sharp.
"You ever ask if he's lonesome?"
"I don't know him,"
she insisted.
"You're here. A woman come alone to his rooms?"
"I came for the Kino cards. Paper cards with holes in them. That's all, I swear."
No answer.
"Do you know what a kinotrope is?"
"Another damn machine," the Texian said wearily.
Another silence.
"Don't lie to me," he said at last. "You're a whore, that's all. You ain't the first whore I ever seen."
She heard him cough behind his kerchief and snort wetly.
"You ain't bad-looking, though," he said. "In Texas, you could marry. Start all over."
"I'm sure that would be wonderful," Sybil said.
"Never enough white women in the country. Get you a decent man, instead of some pimp."
He lifted his kerchief and spat on the floor.
"Hate pimps,"
he announced tonelessly.
"Hate 'em like I hate Injuns. Or Mexicans. Mexican Injuns. French Mexican Injuns with guns. 300-400 strong. On horseback. Got them wind-up rifles. Closest thing to devils on earth."
"But the Texians are heroes,"
Sybil said, desperately trying to remember a name from Houston's speech.
"I heard about Alamo."
"Goliad," the voice gone to a dry whisper. "I was at Goliad."
"I heard about that too," Sybil said quickly. "That must have been glorious."
The Texian hawked, spat again.
"Fought 'em 2 days. No water. Colonel Fannin surrendered. They took us prisoner. All the niceties, polite as you please. Next day they marched us out of town. Shot us down in cold blood. Just lined us up. Massacred us."
Sybil said nothing.
"Massacred the Alamo. Burned all the bodies. Massacred the Mare expedition. Made 'em pick beans. Little clay lottery pot. Pull out a black bean and they kill you. That's Mexicans for you."
"Mexicans," she repeated.
"Comanches are worse."
From somewhere off in the night came the scream of a great friction brake, and then a dull, distant pounding. Black beans. Goliad. Her head was a babel. Beans and massacre and this man whose skin was like leather. He stank like a navvy, of horses and sweat. Down Neal Street she'd once paid tuppence to view a diorama of some vast waste in America, a nightmare of twisted stone. The Texian looked born from such a place, and it came to her then that all the wildernesses of Houston's speech, all the places with such queer, improbable names, were truly real, inhabited by creatures such as this. And Mick had said that Houston had stolen a country once, and now this one had followed, avenging Angel. She fought down an insane desire to laugh. She remembered the old woman then, the vendor of rock oil in Whitechapel, and the queer look she'd given Mick when he'd questioned her. Did others work in concert with the Angel of Goliad? How had so strange a figure managed to enter Grand's tonight, to enter a locked room? Where could such a man hide, even in London, even amid the tattered hordes of American refugees?
"Say he's drunk," the Texian said.
Sybil started horribly.
"What?"
"Houston."
"Oh, yes, in the smoking room. Very drunk."
"Be his last, then." "He alone?"
"He..."
"Mick."
"He's with a tall man. I don't know him."
"Beard on him? Arm broke?"
"I... yes."
He made a sucking sound between his teeth, then leather creaked as he shrugged. Something rattled to Sybil's left. In the faint glow from the curtained window, she glimpsed the gleaming facets of the cut glass doorknob as it began to twist. The Texian leapt from his chair. With the palm of one hand pressed tight against her mouth, he held the great dirk before her, a hideous thing like an elongated cleaver tapering to a point. A length of brass ran along its spine. With the blade inches from her eyes, she saw notches and nicks along the brass. And then the door was opening, Mick ducking through, his head and shoulders stenciled out by the light in the corridor. She must have struck her head against the wall when the Texian flung her aside, but then she was kneeling, the crinoline bunched beneath her, watching the man hoist Mick against the wall, a single great hand about his throat, the heels of Mick's shoes beating a frantic tattoo against the wainscoting, until the long blade struck, twisted, struck again, filling the room with a hot reek of butcher row. And all that happened after, in that room, was a dream to Sybil, or a play she watched, or some kino show wrought with balsa bits so numerous, so tiny, and so cleverly worked as to blur reality, for the Texian, lowering Mick quietly to the floor, closed and relocked the door, his movements unhurried and methodical. She swayed where she knelt, then sagged against the wall behind the bureau. Mick was dragged away, heels scraping into the deeper darkness beside the wardrobe. The Texian knelt over him. There was a rustle of clothing, the slap of the card case flung aside, a jingle of change, and the sound of a single coin falling, rolling, spinning on the hardwood floor. And there came from the door a scratching, the rattle of metal on metal, the sound of a drunken man trying a keyhole. Houston, throwing the door wide, lurched forward on his heavy stick. He belched thunderously and rubbed the side of his old wound.
"Sons of bitches!"
he said, hoarse with drink, listing violently, the stick coming down with a sharp crack at each step.
"Radley! Come out, you little whelp!"
He'd neared the bureau now, and Sybil snatched her fingers back, silently, afraid of the weight of his boots. The Texian closed the door.
"Radley!"
"Evening, Sam."
Her room above the heart seemed distant as childhood's first memories, here in the smell of slaughter, in this dark where giants moved. Houston reeled suddenly to slash at the curtains with his cane, tore them open, gaslight catching the patterns of frost on the glass of each mullioned pane, illuminating the Texian's kerchief and the grim eyes above it, eyes distant and merciless as winter stars. Houston staggered at the sight, the striped blanket sliding from his shoulders. His medals gleamed, quivered.
"Rangers sent me, Sam."
Mick's little pepperbox pistol looked a toy in the Texian's hand, the clustered barrels winking as he took aim.
"Who are you, son?"
Houston asked, all trace of drunkenness abruptly gone from his deep voice.
"You Wallace, take off that neckcloth. Face me man to man."
"You ain't giving no more orders, General. Shouldn't ought to have took what you did. You robbed us, Sam. Where is it? Where's that treasury money?"
"Ranger,"
Houston said, his voice a rich syrup of patience and sincerity,
"you've been misled. I know who sent you, and I know their lies and slanders against me. But I swear to you that I stole nothing. Those funds are mine by right. The sacred trust of the Texas government in exile."
"You sold Texas out for British gold," the ranger said. "We need that money, for guns and food. We're starving, and they're killing us."
A pause.
"And you mean to help them do it?"
"The Republic of Texas can't defy the world's great powers, ranger. I know it's bad in Texas, and my heart aches for my country. But there can't be peace till I'm back in command."
"You got no money left, do you?"
the ranger said.
"I looked, and it ain't here. You sold your fancy estate in the countryside. You threw it all away, Sam, on whores and drink and fancy theater shows for foreigners. And now you want to come back with a Mexican army. You're a thief and a drunk and a traitor."
"God damn you!"
Houston roared and flung open his coat with both hands.
"You're a cowardly assassin, you filthy-mouthed son of a bitch! If you think you have the guts to kill the father of your country, then shoot for the heart!"
He thumped his chest.
"For Texas."
The pepperbox spat a flare of orange flame edged with blue, hurling Houston back against the wall.
Houston crashed to the floor as the Avenger pounced, crouching to thrust the muzzles of the little pistol against the gaudy leopard waistcoat. There was a gun blast into Houston's chest, then another, then a loud snap as the delicate trigger broke in the Ranger's fist. The Ranger flung Nick's gun aside. Houston sprawled, unmoving, red sparks crawling through the fur of the leopard waistcoat. There were sleepy shouts of alarm from another room. The Texian seized Houston's cane and began to batter the window. Glass shattered, crashing to the pavement below. Mullions gave way, and then he was scrambling out across the sill. He froze there for an instant, icy wind tugging at his long coat, and Sybil, in her trance, was reminded of her first sight of him, a vast, dark crow poised now for flight. He jumped from sight, Houston's destroyer, the Angel of Goliad, and was gone, leaving her in silence and rising terror, as if his vanishing had broken a spell. She began to crawl forward, quite without aim and cruelly hampered by her crinoline, yet it was as if her limbs moved of their own accord. The heavy cane lay on the floor, but its head, a gilt brass raven, had snapped free of the shaft. Houston moaned.
"Please be quiet," she said. "You're dead."
"Who are you?"
he said, and coughed. The floor was littered with shards of glass, sharp under her palms. No, bright, like pebbles. The cane, she saw, was hollow, and had spilled its tight nesting of cotton wool where more of the pebbles nested. Bright, bright diamonds. Her hands scooped them together, wadding the cotton wool to thrust the lot into her bodice between her breasts. She turned to Houston then. He still lay on his back, and she watched in fascination as a bloodstain spread along his ribs.
"Help me," Houston grunted. "I can't breathe."
He tugged at his waistcoat's buttons, and it came open, showing neat inner pockets of black silk, stuffed tight with dense packs of paper, thick punch card packs in glued brown wrappers, their intricate perforations surely ruined now by the hot impact of bullets. And blood. For at least one slug had struck him true. Sybil rose and walked giddily toward the door. Her foot squelched moistly in the red-splashed shadows by the wardrobe, and she looked down to see an open card case in red morocco, with a pair of tickets and a heavy nickel plate clip. She stooped, picked it up.
"Get me to my feet,"
Houston demanded, his voice stronger now, tinged with urgency and irritation.
"Where's my walking stick? Where's Radley?"
The room seemed to rock beneath her, like a ship at sea, but she crossed to the door, opened it, stepped out, closed it behind her, and continued, like any gentry girl, along the gas-lit and utterly respectable corridors of Grand's Hotel. The Southeastern Railway Company's London Bridge terminus was a vast, draughty hall of iron and soot-blown glass. Quakers moved among the avenues of benches, offering pamphlets to the seated travellers. Red-coated Irish soldiers, red-eyed from the night's gin, glowered at the close-shaven missionaries as they passed. The French passengers all seemed to be returning home with pineapples, sweet, exotic bounty from the docks of London. Even the plump little actress who sat opposite Sybil had her pineapple, its green spikes protruding from a covered basket at her feet. The train flew through Bermondsey, and out into little streets of new brick, red tile, dust heaps, market gardens, waste ground, a tunnel. The darkness about her stank of burnt gunpowder. Sybil closed her eyes. When she opened them, she saw crows flapping above a barren down, and the wires of the electric telegraph all alive, blurring, moving up and down in the intervals between poles, dancing in the wind of her passage toward France. This image, surreptitiously daguerreotyped by a member of the public morals section of the Sûreté Générale, January 30th, 1855, presents a young woman seated at a table on the terrace of the Café Madeleine, No. 4, Boulevard Malesherbes. The woman, seated alone, has a china teapot and cup before her. Justification of the image reveals certain details of costume, ribbons, frills, her cashmere shawl, her gloves, her earrings, her elaborate bonnet. The woman's clothing is of French origin and new and of high quality. Her face, slightly blurred by long camera exposure, seems pensive, lost in thought. Justification of background detail reveals No. 3 Boulevard Malesherbes, the offices of the Compagnie Sud-Atlantique Transport Maritime. The office window contains a large model steamboat with three funnels, a French-designed craft for the transatlantic colonial trade. A faceless, elderly man, evidently an accidental subject, seems lost in contemplation of the ship. His lone figure emerges, therefore, from the swiftly moving blurs of the Parisian street crowd. His head is bare, his shoulders slump, and he leans heavily on a cane, apparently of cheap rattan. He is as unaware of the young woman's proximity as she is of his. She is Sybil Gerard. He is Samuel Houston. Their paths diverge forever.